going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
six, five, four, three, two, one, zero. Blast off!
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to Mad Science at www.shazizradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, jump over there to the superchat.html where you have access to not one, but three separate chat rooms. Woohoo! Yay! So, basically, what I want to talk to you about today is Stone Age gasoline. I'm going to play part of, probably play the entirety before it's all over with, a 100 years of science of history of gasoline. And it's a lot of stuff you can you can take away from that if you pay attention to what's going on. But basically, I guess just going to be me mouthing off about a bunch of stuff that's ridiculousness. So anyway, before I get into all that, I want to talk about a couple other things. I posted some links in there about gasoline, histories of gasoline and such like that. And also posted a picture in the chat room of a t-shirt that I'm contemplating on putting together. Maybe help promote the Mad Science Show, whatever. Either way, take a look at the t-shirt. Tell me what you think about it. I've got pretty good response from people so far. I think that they said they liked the t-shirt. But nonetheless, just trying to give people some explanation about mad science and get them to come over and maybe all of us get together and do some work or whatever. And so, anyway, let's see, scrolling right down here, Stephen Gibbons also posted in some links relevant as well. And there is a link about UK news. Let's see, I can't remember which college. Anyway, a college making fuel with using microwaves to convert old motor oil into fuel. I don't know where my brain just went. Anyway, back in the old days, whenever they first started making using crude oil, they basically were using it to make kerosene. And back in them days, gasoline was just a byproduct that they threw off in the ironically enough, they dumped it in the creeks and streams and stuff like that, just got rid of it. It was too volatile until somebody came along and started building internal combustion engines. Either way, here we are in the year 2017 and we're still using Stone Age gasoline. That's kind of ridiculousness, but nonetheless, if we're going to be using Stone Age gasoline, I figure we should actually be doing it a little bit more efficient. A lot more efficient, because the average internal combustion engine's only about, I can't remember what it is, 26 or 36% efficient. It's not much at all. So basically the majority of all the fuel that you put in your internal combustion engine gets wasted. One of the videos I popped in there was a man using the sonic vaporizer to vaporize gasoline. And there's actually, if you go out there on YouTube and look up, you'll find a bunch of different people running vehicles and stuff off of gasoline vapors, using pretty similar methods by which this man's doing in this one particular video. And the other one, I can't remember exactly where this individual was, but literally they had a hard time getting Coleman fuel for their lanterns, and so he shows how in his video that he distills gasoline into basically what they would call white gasoline, Coleman fuel. It's a cleaner burn. Takes out all the additives, all the crud and everything. Cambridge. Yeah, that's what it was. Thanks, Stephen. Appreciate that. Cambridge University. They're the ones doing the microwave deal and turning the old oil into gasoline. Anyway, the guy makes the Coleman fuel, and you can see all the leftovers left in the bottom of that from all the additives that they had put in there, and then basically has clean fuel out there on the other side. And so all of this stuff's going to make sense before it's all said and done, if I get my brain together. But I'm going to start playing this deal right here, and I'm probably going to start and stop it a little bit when I find these key points on there. It's about a 40-minute documentary, but there's a lot of really good information in there that I'm betting the majority of the people out there don't realize. And some of the things that we could be doing with fuel. See, the key is efficiency. I mean, if you think about how much fuel is actually being used out there, and then you turn around and factor in the inefficiency of the internal combustion engine being only, 20, 30, some odd percent efficient, that means the majority of all the fuel you buy is getting wasted anyway. And so methods like vaporization and stuff, and only using the amount of fuel necessary, not only would keep all that blow by from crudding up your oil It would keep your engine cleaner and so on. There's so much that science, real science, has to offer, and the industry out there, wait till you hear some of the names of the people in the industry. It's going to blow your doors off. I ain't kidding. Because you want to talk about massive, long-running conspiracies, let's talk about the fuel industry. You're going to hear some things in here, and if you already been, you know, traveled down the rabbit hole and listened to a few things out there, you might be surprised what you hear. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and start playing this, and I'll hit a key spot. I'll probably pause it for a second, or I might even just mouth off right during the whole doggone thing, you know. How rude, I guess. But either way, here we go. Let's see if we can play this direct, because I'm not going to try to download this. I'm just going to play it. Here we go.
Complex refinery separated from oil. A massive infrastructure delivers it to every service station in America. Without gasoline, modern life would grind to a halt. More than 100 years of science and sweat have transformed it from an unwanted waste product to our most vital fossil fuel. Now, gasoline on Modern Marvels. Where would we be without gasoline? Put away the Porsche. No more NASCAR. So long, speedboat. Hang up the Harley. Ground that plane. Take away the tank. Gasoline fuels the world. And not just the fast and the furious. Businesses, commuters, and even soccer moms depend on it.
Worldwide, gasoline is extremely important. Third world countries are aspiring to become modern, and as they do so, the demand for gasoline goes up. Mobility is very important.
And for better or worse, Americans rely more heavily on gasoline than any other country.
In Europe and some other countries, there's more emphasis on public transportation. Here in the United States, people are used to taking their cars everywhere they go. So if suddenly, you know, gasoline disappeared from the universe, Americans would have a pretty hard time going about their daily lives.
Drivers in the USA use about 360 million gallons of gasoline every single day. That's big business, to say the least.
Without gasoline, modern cities would not exist in the way they do in the U.S. We've built a mass transit system around one or two people driving in automobiles all around a large metropolitan area. We're making adjustments to that, needed adjustments, carpooling, but it's hard to imagine a time when our economy won't rely heavily on gasoline and gasoline-powered vehicles.
One reason why gasoline will be around for a long time is that it provides a lot of power. 1 gallon of gasoline provides the equivalent of more than 36,000 watt-hours of energy, enough to run a colored television for more than a month. There are some alternatives that provide even more energy, like hydrogen-powered fuel cells. But right now, gasoline gives us all the other things we need in a fuel that the other options can't yet match.
We're asking it to provide low emissions, good fuel economy. We're asking it to not contribute to deposit buildup in the engine or contribute to the failure of emissions control equipment. We want it to be fully available when we want it and as low a cost as possible.
That lowest possible price isn't always as cheap as we'd like. But considering all the steps gasoline goes through before it enters your tank, it's still a pretty good bargain. Crude oil has to be found, brought up from thousands of feet below the surface.
Okay, I got to figure out why it is. That's a happening. Apparently the volume's low on one side. Ed Burnett, what the heck is going on over here? Who created the ruckus? That's what I want to know. Let's see. Do-do-do-do-do. Volume control. Alright, so I'm having a problem, I guess. My volume control isn't working right. Dad, burn it. This is terrible for live radio. Let me see here. Okay. System headphones. Boing! Alright, let's try that for a second. Let me know if it's any better there, Steven.
Shipped thousands of miles to a billion-dollar refinery. Squeezed through all of that expensive refining equipment. Moved to cities through thousands of miles of underground pipelines. Pumped into tanker trucks. And delivered to service stations.
Look at the price of a gallon of gasoline, especially after you subtract the taxes, versus the price of a gallon of bottled water. Gasoline is around a dollar a gallon, plus or minus, after you subtract taxes. And we're hard-pressed to find even a liter of bottled water that isn't well over a dollar a gallon.
Obviously, bottled water makers aren't selling 360 million gallons a day. But the main reason gasoline is cheaper is an efficient production and delivery infrastructure. And the modern refinery is at the heart of that system. Refineries are huge billion-dollar complexes, often covering the area of 100 football fields. In a single day, a large refinery can transform 400,000 barrels of crude oil into millions of gallons of gasoline and other refined products. Despite their size, all of the work is being done on a molecular scale. The crude oil fed into the refinery is made almost entirely of hydrocarbons. Chains of carbon atoms in various lengths, surrounded by hydrogen. Inside the refinery, all of these hydrocarbon chains are separated in what are known as fractionating towers or columns. One of the most distinctive features of any refinery. Furnaces next to the tower heat the oil to about 700 degrees Fahrenheit. The hydrocarbons boil off like steam from shortest to longest, except for the thickest semi-solid products.
And there are a series of trays in the column, so the lighter product will rise as a gas through what's called bubblers. They actually allow a liquid level to stay on the tray. The gas comes through until it comes to the point where it condenses at that level of cooling. We can draw off those fractions.
The lighter materials have just a few carbons in each molecule. For example, propane with 3 carbons. And butane, a 4-carbon
chain.
Okay,
that may be the best I can get it.
These will go right out of the top of the tower since they are still in a gaseous form, even after they cool back down to normal temperatures. Gasoline is mostly comprised of fairly light molecules with between 6 and 10 carbons. They rise nearly to the top of the column before condensing back to liquid. The liquid is then removed through side tubes. Kerosene, slightly heavier, weighs in at 12 to 15 carbons. Diesel fuel settles and condenses just below that, since it's in the 15 to 18 carbon range. Lubricating oils, including engine motor oils, are even thicker, since they have longer chains than gasoline or diesel. And the heavyweight products, with 20 or more carbons in each chain, collect at the bottom of the tower. These materials, such as paraffin wax and tar, are in a semi-solid state and never totally vaporize. That's a lot of diversity for something referred to as crude.
Yeah, let me pause that there for a second. See, that crude oil, you can see in this video, which would probably might be better off just watching it yourself, but I'm going to still try to play a bit of it. I missed a couple points in there. Anyway, the one lady was saying, where would we be without gasoline? Well, we'd probably be a lot better off, I suppose. But the whole key is that it's not that we don't have a good fuel in gasoline. It's that we're not using it efficiently. And, you know, if you look at all the products that are made from crude oil, and you think about how much money is actually in the fuel industry alone, you can see why it is that science has pretty much hindered Well, not necessarily science by itself, but mostly the doggone industries have hindered science into producing anything that's going to compete with that deal. Now, see, most people think, well, you know, if you could do this, like run your car on water, then they'd already be doing it. Well, you'll find out later on this podcast right here, they're already talking about hydrogen technology and even going to the point where saying it's got clean emissions, which making it even better yet. But, you know, the industry is like a big, huge ball and chain on the scientific community, because we have the technology and the knowledge right now where we should be so much more advanced. But once again, the infrastructure that's already into place, they're also talking about, well, you'd have to start all over with a new type of infrastructure if you were going to move to hydrogen, and solar's not quite ready yet, and this and that. And there's about a billion and one excuses why it is you can't get any further than where we are today, because this infrastructure, as far as the refinery industry and fuel industry, coal, whatever, they're already there. And it's almost as if people just, don't want to put the extra effort into making, a better, cleaner fuel system. Now, they're tweaking what they got going on there and trying to make it more efficient and adding octane boosters and stuff like that to keep from premature detonation and all. And so, you know, there's a lot of science that goes on behind the scenes. And so when you try to argue the fact that, you know, scientists have pretty much dropped the ball and allowed industry to run roughshod over the communities out there, the further you get into this documentary and listen to all the different things that were going on in history and how at one point in time the fuel industry was a huge monopoly owned by one of the well-known family names, you'll see. We'll just keep on going. But nonetheless, there's so much resistance against anything on the outside of that. That's not conspiracy theory. That's conspiracy fact. You know, because the basic science for running to literally engineer perfectly engineered machines that would run on better types of fuels already there. It's going to have to take the average Joe to do this research by themselves, like you see these backyard scientists, what they'd call them or whatever. Some people can call them pseudoscience, which I hate that word. It just makes me sick to my stomach. It's real science if you're actually doing the scientific method and you're testing and so on and so forth, testing and being able to repeat your experiments and such. Let me play some more of this right here.
It is a progression out of a barrel of crude oil, all the way from very simple molecules that we can use in our gas grills for our barbecues to very heavy molecules that go into road tar. And gasoline is just a slice out of that carbon progression.
But why do the 6 to 10 carbon chains in gasoline work better in internal combustion engines than some heavier or lighter petroleum product? Because gasoline gives you the best of both worlds. It can be stored as a liquid, which takes up less room than a gas. But it vaporizes more easily than any other liquid hydrocarbon. A step the engine's combustion chamber can't do without.
The liquid gasoline will not combust. It has to be in a vapor state. If you don't get proper vaporization at the time of combustion, you'll generally have what's termed a misfire.
See, did you hear that? They're talking about you can't burn gasoline in a liquid. You got to vaporize it. And so with that said, if you study how the actual injectors on the modern-day electronic ignition system, fuel injection systems work, then you'll see they're pushing too much fuel into these cars. And I've been saying it for years. You know, they're shoving too much fuel down inside there, and they're not allowing enough time for a complete burn like you would be getting if you had that vaporization process, which was actually pushing the fuel into the system.
And of course that results in poor performance, poor fuel economy, high emissions.
So when you put the pedal to the metal, gasoline is pumped from the tank to the engine. It mixes with air just before entering the combustion chamber, changing the liquid to a vapor. The vapor is squeezed as the cylinder comes up for more power, and a spark plug ignites the mixture. The force of the explosion propels the piston down, turning the crankshaft, which is connected to the transmission, which uses gears to send the right amount of power to the wheels for smooth acceleration. But some gasolines provide better acceleration and overall performance than others, which is the reason for the range of prices at the pump. The biggest difference between the best grades of gasoline, usually called premium, ultimate, or supreme, and the middle and regular grades is the octane rating. It measures the ability of the fuel to be compressed without spontaneously igniting before the piston is in position and the spark plug fires.
If you have octane that is too low in your gasoline, the gases are self-igniting before the piston can get to the top.
Aha! So, you're getting compression ignition before the spark plug ever even fires. And that's another one of the things that I tried to argue with some so-called mechanics or machinists or whatever you want to call it, talk on. They consider themselves to be engineers or whatever. That if this thing was timed out just right, you wouldn't even need a doggone spark plug to run this, especially with vaporization. You'd be able to only inject as much fuel as necessary into this vehicle as it requires it to push the piston down. And in fact, when you smash your foot down on the gas, so to speak, like they were saying in the video, when you put the pedal to the metal, you would be using less fuel. You would have to cut back on the fuel, because the only time you need fuel is in order for that to be compressed and ignited, which you would be doing on the upstroke of the piston. That way, once it got to the top and it smashed all that the fuel molecules together and caused it to spontaneously ignite, you wouldn't be igniting it prematurely. You'd be igniting it right when you needed it. And we have the capability to engineer an engine that would do just that.
And when this happens, this works against the power of your automobile. It decreases the power. Plus, it's very hard on the mechanical parts.
Octane is the name of the 8-carbon molecule that is part of gasoline. It can handle compression without igniting so well that they named the rating scale after it. At the other end is 7-carbon heptane. Squeeze it just a little, and it'll ignite. Scientists in the late 20s created an artificial scale, assigning heptane a 0 and octane a rating of 100. This way, unknown fuels could be tested and compared to pure octane or pure heptane. So a gasoline with an 87 octane rating performs as if it contained 87% octane and 13% heptane, even though it actually contains molecules of many different lengths. The frustrating thing about octane is that low octane would please most engines most of the time. You only need that high octane a fraction of the time. During those extra bursts of power when accelerating. But long before anyone cared about octane, or even gasoline for that matter, there was another product that dominated the early oil business. Next, drilling the first oil well, and the birth of the refining industry. In America, gasoline is the most widely used petroleum product. More than 40% of each barrel of oil is made into gasoline. Considering the wide range of products in addition to gasoline that can be derived from crude oil, it's no wonder people make such a big deal about the price of a barrel of this smelly, gooey substance. And the whole fuss started in 1859, when a man named Edwin Drake drilled the first oil well.
The well was drilled in 1859 to a total depth of 69.5 feet. Within less than a year, over 1,500 wells had been drilled in and around Titusville, Pennsylvania, primarily because oil was close and shallow near the surface.
Experiments at the time had shown that boiling small amounts of crude oil that had already bubbled to the surface allowed chemists to collect a new product known as kerosene, which could be used to light lamps. The drilling frenzy in Titusville began because Drake had proven there were vast amounts of oil farther underground. This great supply allowed kerosene to light lamps more cheaply than its blubbery competitor.
Where whale blubber was becoming in short supply, the future of whale oil seemed in question, and suddenly, magically, somebody comes up with this product that can be made from something coming out from the ground.
Kerosene was separated from the rest of the crude oil materials in primitive refineries. They were appropriately called stills.
The early refineries were basically just like a drum with a tube sticking out of it. It was very similar to what the moonshiners used to do.
The process known as distillation boiled oil until it vaporized. Then the kerosene vapors were collected and condensed back to liquid form. In the 1800s, people couldn't have cared less about the gasoline which boiled and condensed just before the kerosene did.
Before there was an obvious market for gasoline, it was seen as a nuisance. And after the refining process had produced the most kerosene that you could get out of it, quite often the gasoline would be dumped into a nearby stream and float on away.
Now, did you hear what he just said? He said that they used to dump it down in the doggone stream and it'd float away. As Stephen Gibbons in the chat room said, you can keep your carbon-based fuel, gasoline, hydrogen. I want my electromagnetic anti-gravity vehicle, and I ain't going away until I get one. I'm with you, brother. That's what I want. He said, then I'm out of here. I hear Venus nice this time of year. Well, I don't know, man. If science is right, Venus don't seem to be that comfortable. But, you know, hey, to each his own, brother. So, anyway, let's go. But, see, that's the whole thing. They were dumping the gasoline, which used to be a waste product of making kerosene back in the day. They dumped that right down in the creek. Stinks to be somebody downstream smoking, I guess. All right, well, anyway, or the fumes, anyway. Let's just keep rolling here.
Throughout the late 1800s, refining remained simple and was a cheap business to enter. Anyone could become a refiner. Then one refinery owner in Cleveland figured out how to outdo all of these small-time competitors. John D. Rockefeller said, if you can't beat them, then buy them. Instead of taking his profits early, he poured the money back into his company to buy refineries and the companies that transported.
Yeah, let's stop that for a second there again. John D. Rockefeller, huh? That name sound familiar out there in the conspiracy world? Yeah, right. He's buying up all the refineries and building a monopoly that went on for quite some time until something or another ended up busting it up, and you got the modern day fuel industry. But let's keep rolling. Either way, that's one of the names to keep an eye out there.
Oil and kerosene.
The Rockefeller Trust, which was created in the late 1800s, was put in place primarily to take advantage of the large number of small independent producers. In other words, gathering these into a large entity. But because of the concentration of power, the concentration of all the resources, it really became a monopoly.
By 1880, Rockefeller's company controlled 90% of America's refining capacity. But just as kerosene had bumped whale oil off the market years earlier, very soon Thomas Edison's new invention would turn out the lights on the kerosene business. Fortunately for Rockefeller, the various people tinkering in their garages with the first automobiles found that gasoline worked best for internal combustion engines.
Henry Ford came along and started manufacturing cars with the combustion engine. That created a whole new market for the oil industry to really focus itself on this new product, gasoline. It was just found market, unbelievable expansion, just beyond people's wildest dreams.
Gasoline, the former hazardous nuisance, became the oil industry's savior. Between 1900 and 1910, the number of cars in America skyrocketed from about 10,000 to over 500,000.
and just about all of these cars needed gasoline. Refiners had to become more efficient to keep up with demand. Fractionating towers, which first appeared in 1908, improved distillation by allowing refiners to separate gasoline and other products from oil more quickly and accurately than earlier stills. This process turned about 15 to 20% of the oil into not-so-great gasoline, with octane ratings only in the 20s and 30s. But even with big oil discoveries in Texas in the early 1900s, those 500,000 cars on the road in 1910 were still stretching the limits of gasoline production. Refiners loved all of that business, but they had to come up with more gasoline. The answer came from this lab at Standard Oil of Indiana, one of the smaller companies created after Teddy Roosevelt broke up Rockefeller's Standard Oil monopoly. In 1911, scientist William Burton came up with a new process that finally cracked the case.
He comes up with the idea for cracking, to make more gasoline per barrel of oil as opposed to just separating out what they can. But it's a difficult process.
Hydrocarbon molecules longer than gasoline, which had been collected in the fractionating tower, would be broken into pieces, creating more molecules in gasoline's range of 6 to 10 carbon chains. To break those longer chains, thermal cracking required temperatures of up to 700 degrees Fahrenheit and pressures many times that of normal atmosphere.
There's a key word inside this deal right here where it talks about hydrocarbons that they're trying to get up out of this process of refining. And so essentially you're talking about basically water and carbon mixture in order to get the fuel, so to speak. So I'll hold my tongue on that one for a second, but anyway, let's go back to the video here.
And it scares the people running Standard Oil quite a bit. And they say, Mr. Burton, we're afraid you might blow the whole state of Indiana into Lake Michigan with this kind of pressure in a major refinery.
Luckily for the people of Indiana, thermal cracking worked. The cracked shorter chains were sent back to a fractionating tower and collected. Suddenly, almost 50% of a barrel of oil could be turned into gasoline. And the octane was higher, too, with a rating of about 70. In order to avoid offering consumers two wildly different qualities of gasoline, the higher-grade cracked gasoline was mixed with the inferior distilled gasoline to provide drivers with fuel in the 40 to 50 octane range. Thermal cracking spread throughout the industry, despite the expenses involved with such high heat and pressures. But refiners also wanted a way to boost the octane of the lower quality distilled gasoline. In 1922, chemist Thomas Midgley led the way.
Refiners looked for some additive that could kind of push the refining process and more quickly give us better gasoline. The research group that came up with the addition of tetraethyl lead in the 19-teens and early 20s was a heavyweight group.
By 1925, the addition of lead helped boost consumer octane levels of gasoline about 10 to 15 points into the mid-50 range. The lead attached to gasoline molecules, making them more resistant to spontaneous combustion during compression. The quality kept getting better, but all that roaring around in the 1920s made quantity a problem once again. Competition was also racing ahead, with many more companies offering gasoline than today. Some were foreign-owned, such as Royal Dutch and the English companies Shell and British Petroleum. Many others were spin-offs created when Standard Oil was dissolved a decade earlier.
And those smaller regional companies are the brands that we think of today when we drive down the highway. They are the Amoco and Exxon, Mobil. Those were all units of Standard Oil as controlled by the Rockefeller Empire.
Demand didn't increase as quickly during the Great Depression. At the same time, future supply didn't appear to be a problem when the first large oil reserves in the Middle East were discovered in 1938. But it would be several years before that oil would be available. And the beginning of World War II in 1939
led to a new critical need for gasoline and other oil products for military use. American refiners came through for the Allies by developing a new version of cracking that further increased gasoline yields from oil. Catalysts such as clays or precious metals were added to thermal cracking's extreme heat and pressure to crack the heavier hydrocarbons that wouldn't break before. Following another trip through a fractionating tower, gasoline yields from a barrel of oil went from about 45% to over 50%.
The greatest advantage that the Allied forces had in World War II was an abundance of petroleum and petroleum products versus the Japanese and the Germans. Almost immediately after the beginning of hostilities, the industry was organized under the government to greatly expand the capacity.
A completely new refining process in 1940 also helped fuel the Allied advantage during World War II. Besides breaking up heavier hydrocarbons, catalysts were also used to perform some molecular molding. Catalytic reforming created chemical reactions, which reshaped low-octane molecules into more desirable high-octane configurations. Superior fuel and firepower led the Allies to victory. After the war, gasoline helped ignite a post-war consumer boom. And it was clear that Americans were going to need a lot of gasoline to fuel this lavish new lifestyle. Next, making sense of the maze of pipes, towers, and other units inside a modern refinery. The first gas pumps had no displays at all. Customers in the early 1900s had to simply trust that the attendant was charging them for the right amount of fuel. From a distance, gasoline-producing refineries looked pretty chaotic. Thick towers and thin towers placed at seemingly random intervals. Also dotting the landscape are squatty structures and storage tanks of various shapes and sizes. And all of this is connected by a spaghetti bowl of pipes, heading off in all directions. But there is a method to the seeming madness.
It really does follow a flow. You can follow the flow of crude oil coming in. It then goes to certain processes depending on how it's separated. And the reason that there are so many pipes going around the refinery is that we have to keep all those products separate.
After arriving by tanker ship at the dock from the large oil fields of the world in Alaska, Mexico, Venezuela, and the Middle East, crude oil heads to a good old-fashioned distillation unit with a new twist. Refiners use vacuum pressure, creating conditions below normal atmospheric pressure to lower the boiling point of the materials, which lowers their big heating bills. Instead of 700 degrees, temperatures of 400 to 500 degrees Fahrenheit now do the trick. Like those of early refineries, the fractionating towers initially separate only about 20% of the oil into gasoline. The heavier products move to modern cat crackers, which now use fluid catalysts instead of solids to break things faster. And for the refiners, the quicker the cracking happens, the more gasoline they can squeeze out the other end in a single day. Another cracking process developed in the 1960s combines 1,000 degree heat, pressure up to 200 times atmosphere, and free-floating hydrogen atoms.
Hydrocracking is a cracking process that's done in the presence of hydrogen. And so whereas other processes will give you a variety of different kinds of molecules, hydrocracking tends to give you just straight carbon chains that will be fully loaded up with the hydrogen.
Straight carbon chains completely surrounded by hydrogen atoms are desirable because they are easy to reshape into high-octane gasoline later on. The light gases which traveled out the top of the distillation tower head to an alkylation unit. This time, low temperatures just above freezing and low pressures, along with acid catalysts, are used to join molecules.
The best thing about alkylation is the product that we get out of alkylation units is very high in octane.
Reforming units, similar to those developed during World War II,
still use catalysts and heat to reshape gasoline molecules into the most desirable shapes. For reasons that even a chemist is hard-pressed to explain, ring-shaped gasoline molecules are higher in octane and burn cleaner, something which became very important in the 1970s, when refiners were ordered to get the lead out, which was still being added to gasoline to boost octane.
When we discovered that lead was becoming deposited along roadways and posed a hazard to children, there was an effort to remove lead from gasoline. So we had to find other ways to boost octane and provide that performance, but those processes increased the cost of producing gasoline.
The bar for low pollution gasoline.
Let me remind people of something right here. See, octane sounds like it's a misnomer to me, because essentially it's to keep the fuel from pre-detonation so that you get a better burn on it, on the doggone deal. But most folks, when they hear the word octane boosters, they're going to think that that means that the car, that's going to make the fuel stronger. It's it's really not. It's just kind of keeping it more stable so that it don't use compression ignition like a diesel engine would be. And so if you, there's a noise that your car will make when it's pre-detonating, it's like a little pinging noise, and they come some, and sometimes when you go to shut your vehicle off, it won't shut off quite well. They call it dieseling. So when you shut the ignition off, the doggone thing still wants to stay running, which is really obnoxious. So anyway, let's get back to it, but remember that about the whole octane thing. It's it's kind of a twist on words, if you ask me.
Octane was raised even higher in 1990 when Congress passed the Clean Air Act.
The most difficult thing we've asked refiners to do is, since the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments, is to come up with cleaner burning gasolines targeted for specific regions.
We have gasoline standards for cities like Los Angeles or Houston, where the air pollution is...
Okay, now this is where it's getting into one of the things that aggravates the heck out of me and probably should aggravate the heck out of everybody else. See, when they're talking about carbon emissions and you know, Clean Air Act and all that kind of stuff, this gets into a stage of ridiculousness above and beyond ludicrous. Because if you had a proper detonation every single time, if you had a perfectly clean running engine, you wouldn't have no crud coming out of the doggone exhaust. Now, they showed that hydrogen technology, it only produces water vapor. And so, really, there's no reason to even be burning basically what they call fossil fuel, which is another big lie, nonetheless. Dinosaur fuel. Alright, we're running dinosaur gas is what they say. But either way, now that we're running dinosaur gas, and so many people running dinosaur gas, and they took lead out of it because the lead was giving all the kids brain damage is what they say back in the day. And so now we need to be able to get clean burn every time, and so they throw a catalytic converter on there to burn off whatever your engine can't burn off. And so that would be a red flag to me, be like, look, if your engine is only 36% efficient, then something ain't engineered properly, period. You're not getting a proper burn if you're spewing out most of your fuel. Now, if you can stand behind that doggone vehicle and you can smell it and it smells it like it's running lean, you can actually smell gasoline, well, then that ought to tell you that you're not burning it properly. You know, it's ridiculousness. It just don't make any doggone sense to me. You know, the auto industry, you know, basically, you know, somebody one time said that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, you know, internal combustion engines, they have a lot of power. They're trying to make them as most efficient as possible, blah, blah. And they're, you know, trying to tweak it at all times, trying to tweak the fuel, trying to get it to be, you know, more efficient, use less fuel. It's the biggest hock-a-hooey in the history of hocks-a-hooeys, man. Everything from carbon emissions to we can't do it because it's too technically hard or whatever. Give me a break, folks. If you properly engineer any engine, I don't care what engine it is, you might have to go back to the drawing board on how you have the valves set on this thing, your exhaust ports on there, where they're actually sitting inside there. But there's a boat company called Evinrude who made a direct injected motor which is way more efficient than all the other boat engines out there on the market. Gets better fuel, better performance, and all that kind of stuff. And they took a little bit of physics and everything that they've learned, and even some of the things that I've been saying all along, and they made a boat motor that is a two-stroke boat motor with multi-cylinders that runs more efficiently than all the other competition on the market. And there are even people out there designing high-end sports cars that are getting really good efficiency on the thing, and actually a lot more horsepower, more bang for the buck, so to speak. So it isn't that, you know, society couldn't have done this already. I mean, we're in the year 2017, and we still talking about, you know, smoky, smog-filled cities because of all the cars and all that. You know, give me a break, man. You want to know why I call it mad science? Because this is pure ridiculousness. If you look over a city and there's a cloud over the top of the city, you know, imagine if that was back during the days whenever they had lead. Everybody'd be stupid because they'd all have brain damage from the lead poisoning and such. But there's so many better fuels out there. And even in the electric car industry, whatever, there's ways by which you can make incredible efficient electric engines. There's a guy out there that I subscribe to on YouTube called Sky Collection, and as far as I'm concerned, he is on the just the right there on the edge of actually showing the world a perfect efficient electric motor and motor generator for that matter. And it would not even be surprising to see this man with his craftsmanship and what he's been doing with these pulse motors and stuff to be able to make this not only super efficient but self-charging as well. Now, of course, you're going to get the knuckleheads come rolling up out of the dang woodwork hollering, "Oh, laws of thermodynamics, laws of thermodynamics, you can't do it, you can't get out more than you put in. We don't want to get out more than we put in, stupid. We just want to try to use it as most efficient as possible." And when he shuts this thing off, he shuts the power supply off of this motor, it runs for several minutes after he shut the doggone thing off. And so all he'd have to do is throw another circuit on there that would basically charge a capacitor and run a secondary circuit and let the one rest long enough to charge that one back up, and he's got a perpetual motion device that science says wasn't even remotely possible. Because the idiots out there who don't understand that you can get something to be self-contained because the laws of thermodynamics. Every time they say that, it just makes me so incredibly mad to hear some idiot who thinks himself to be educated come out there and start arguing the second law of thermodynamics, first law of thermodynamics, any of the laws of thermodynamics to try to disprove free energy, which is all around us everywhere you look. And so they're talking about a self-contained closed loop system, you know, that you can't, it won't start itself, it won't produce its own power, won't run itself, and there's no, that's what they use to try to disprove perpetual motion. The laws of thermodynamics are the biggest hindrance to society as far as science goes, and it just drives me bonkers to hear somebody, especially a really well-talented person who can build an internal combustion engine because they have all the skill sets of being able to mill and, you know, measure and make these parts. You know, it's just incredible. And then you hear them start quoting the laws of thermodynamics why you can't get something done. You know? It drives me freaking nuts. Because it isn't that we don't have the energy, and it isn't that we couldn't even, I don't even care if there's has to be an outside power source. And it's not because of the terminology not being able to be classified as perpetual motion because it's not a self-contained closed loop system. It has to have something on the outside that helps to maintain it. But if you got the system that's actually charging the secondary system, or they're even supplementing each other to the extent where this thing never shuts off unless you shut it off, that's perpetual motion to me. I don't care what anybody says. That's free energy. Now, it's just pure ridiculousness. And Stephen said, lead to increase octane, so we were disinformed about it acting as a lubricant and protecting your pistons, rings, and tappets, and I'm shocked to the core. They never trust a oil company-sponsored scientist again. You know, that's what I'm saying. We were told that it was going to help to make that engine better and whatever, you know, protect it or whatever. There was basically just to try to get the premature detonation going down. You know, like you, Stephen, you pointed out there, these folks, the story keeps changing every time it gets inconvenient. Anytime you get anywhere close to saying that there's an alternative to the mainstream fuel industry or energy industry, this is the kind of craziness you have to deal with. But if you go back and listen to some of these old documentaries, and you listen to where oil came from, to where the whole history of how they used to use it just for kerosene, and they used to waste gasoline, dump it straight down in the doggone creek, for Pete's sake. And now look where we're at today, you know. People out there fighting wars over oils when there ain't even no reason to even fight war over oil, because the hydrocarbon, you know, hydrogen is still being burned in your vehicle, people. I don't care what anybody's trying to tell you. There's still things going on in there with hydrogen and oxygen. There's water and gasoline, you know. And so with that said, this whole concept that you can't run a car on pure distilled water is ridiculousness. There's actually, Raymond, I think, was talking about this at one point, said something about there used to be a guy that developed this doggone deal that you could throw down inside some water and basically make fuel. Well, if you think about the chemistry of all that kind of stuff, it's not that far beyond the realm. You're trying to burn carbon inside there, and you need some oxygen to burn it, and you need a little bit of hydrogen boost to help it out. So it's not like we couldn't turn, even if we had to, turn water literally into gasoline. And there's so many different types of carbon out there. I mean, the world is a carbon-based deal, and you know, you burn coal, what's that? Carbon. You burn oil, it's got carbon in it. Everything's got carbon in it. You know, the only thing, water molecules, hydrogen and oxygen. Those are basically, I guess you'd call like a catalyst or something to help the process of the carbon igniting and whatever. You know, getting it to burn, producing heat, which in turn produces pressure and so on down the line. If you wanted to properly engineer an engine to basically distribute heat where you wanted it to go, you could build a perfectly clean running engine that would run off of pure distilled water. Try to tell that to any mechanic out there. Try to tell that to any mainstream scientist or anybody who supposedly internal combustion engine engineer or whatever you want to call them. It's ridiculousness, man. You know, basic science has just went by the wayside, and science is gone. The real mainstream science is not science. It's some sort of make it up as you go religion that just won't go away. And everybody thinks, well, you know, these guys are all this educated, and they got it all figured out, and we're just trusted scientists. They know what they're talking about. And then they turn around and start boo-hooing about global warming and climate change and smog over their city, and we got to get clean burning emissions, and we got to get away from fossil fuels. And you got a guy out here with crazy hair sitting there saying, look, we got all the doggone answers. Why are we still jacking around with dinosaur fuel? Seriously, Stone Age gasoline. Why are we still using Stone Age gasoline? And all the waste products that are made inside your car, when your car gets all cruddy, do you know why it is that your oil is black whenever you're done using it? It's because it's loaded down with carbon, which is fuel. Dad, burn it, folks. When are you going to get your act together? You're going to drive me to drinking. I ain't kidding, man. This is insane. If the planet's heating up due to carbon emissions, which is a big, big joke, it's another one of the major hawks of hooies of all hawks of hooies, and it drives me freaking batty. Because here's the gig. You know, those folks that go climb Mount Everest, which I believe is about 10,000 feet, don't quote me on it because I don't really care how tall that mountain is, but I know it's high enough that the oxygen levels are really thin up there. And so they like to take, extra oxygen in case they get in trouble. They can, have something to breathe. And then when you get in an aircraft and you get up to certain 14,000 feet, you got to start pressurizing the cabin, and you got to have oxygen tanks inside there, and you got to have some sort of carbon scrubber to scrub off the CO2 so that you don't suffocate inside the doggone airplane while you're trying to go to Texas or wherever it is you're flying to. And so, you know, if oxygen can't make it up that high, then how is it something that's heavier than oxygen making up that high, getting trapped in the atmosphere? Now I could see it potentially getting trapped at lower levels in the atmosphere, but even that. Look, if you were standing around, there was enough CO2 in the air to literally be above your head, you'd be dead. That's it. Oxygen is heavier, or CO2 is heavier than oxygen, and so it displaces oxygen, and so basically you can't breathe. And so, don't tell me one thing in basic science and then sit there to lie to the masses out there and say, oh, we got a CO2 problem. Go ask the greenhouses why it is that they flood their greenhouses with CO2 when nobody's in there. First, you don't want to be in there while they're flooding the thing with CO2 because you'll suffocate. Second is, the plants, through a process called photosynthesis that you learned about in basic science, scrubs off the carbon and releases fresh oxygen, and there you go, man. It turns the plant turns the carbon into sugar, and that's food for the plant. They thrive. The plants grow better in a high CO2 enriched environment. I don't even know where to begin to tell you why that makes me mad. That angers me. That's why I call it mad science. It frustrates me because these people out there, these supposed to be the most highly educated individuals, scientists trying to figure out ways to tweak molecules in gas to get a better burn or add some octane to it so that you don't get premature detonation. You wouldn't be getting premature detonation on your engine if you was firing it the way it was supposed to be to begin with, what it should be. I mean, if you know that after a certain temperature that engine is going to cause that gas to spontaneously combust, ignite itself on the upstroke, then stop putting fuel in until you get all the way up there to the top. Because then all you need is just a tiny bit of fuel, and then you ignite that with the compression as it gets right up there. When that doggone piston's almost up to top dead center, then you inject a fine mist inside there, and that heat and pressure will instantaneously ignite that fuel and push that piston right back down again. And if I'm if I can figure this out and they can't, well, somebody better shut down them colleges, because they ain't doing a very good job of educating. They're doing a more better job of indoctrinating people into stupidity, because you got somebody who's supposedly really educated arguing about the laws of thermodynamics. You know, they got words like endothermic that, just look it up. I ain't even gonna go into it. It really frustrates the heck out of me, man. You can actually cool your doggone pistons down in the properly engineered engine by the way that you use your fuel and such. And so it's just, It just drives me nuts, man. Stephen typed in there, Garrett Electrolytic Carburetor, 1935, from the resource page, had a company making these with his father. I wonder if they were bought out also. I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it because, you know, if you're out there and your main goal is to sell fuel to make money, and I want to back up just here. When you talk about this documentary, let's talk about the fact that whenever they're making this, how they're separating while they're refining it into kerosene and all different types of fuels and such. Out of that one product, they're getting multitudes of products. Out of that one product, they're turning it into several types of fuels, all kinds of stuff for making rubbers and plastics and everything else. And then when you look at this major pipeline and you think about they're just pumping oil down through that to the refinery, no ma'am, no sir, they're not just pumping oil down through there. They're pumping oil and several different types of fuels because the oil's thick, the other product's a little thinner, and so on down the line, and so they can literally pipe it through the same pipe, keep them all separated for the most part, with the exception by the time they get down there, some of which will have to be re-refined a little bit, but nonetheless, they're using the same pipeline system to send down multiple products at the same doggone time all over the entire world. And so, it's a wonder fuel. It's a wonder source of power, you know, but, you know, if you can't even get it to burn cleanly in your vehicle because you don't know how to properly engineer something using the basic laws of physics, then where are we at? This is year 2017, man, and we should be so much further. We're getting ready to go into year 2018, and we're still talking about carbon emissions. Give me a break, man. They don't want them to run better. They don't want your engine to last longer. They want to be able to sell you a product. That's the whole doggone thing. Electric companies, they don't care if your house is efficient. They say they do. Matter of fact, I had a power company guy out here at my house, and I asked him, I said, why does the power company keep sending me this notice saying that I'm using 70% more energy than all my neighbors? And the first thing come up out of his mouth, he said, that's just propaganda. And it made sense. I'm going to have to go ask my neighbors, did you get a doggone deal that said that you're using 70% more than your neighbors? Because I'm guessing they all did. Everyone got the same doggone deal. You're using 70% more than your neighbors. That's a big, man. It's a lucky I ain't a foul-mouthed heathen because I'd be going on a rant of epic proportions. Anyway, that's what's going on out there, folks. And if the people out there really want to seriously get off of the Stone Age gasoline and into more cleaner burning fuels and working more closer harmony with nature, ask a guy like me. I'll give you some ideas. And there's other guys and gals out there that know the same thing I'm trying to tell everybody, but yet we're up against the wall. We're fighting against a Goliath of industry that doesn't want change. That, why would you want change? If you can sell billions and billions of gallons of fuel and crude oil, knowing you're never going to run out, and the only reason why they even mess around with the other people across in the Middle East is because they know that if they get their refining capabilities down to the letter, you know, instead of saying, oh, we'll buy your oil, we'll refine it, and we'll ship you back some gasoline, and they'll say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. We won't have to build no refineries. Well, they could do it themselves and save. But nonetheless, if you're going to bring their oil over here, refine it, and they're not refining their own oil, that makes them at the mercy to you, and that doesn't give you any competition, because maybe they can sell their doggone gasoline for 10 cents a gallon when you're trying to sell yours for $2, $3 and up a gallon. See, that's the whole scam. You know, Rockefeller and Teddy Roosevelt had to separate Rockefeller because they had a monopoly on the fuel industry. Everybody else wanted a piece of the pie, and he was hogging it all. And so they come in there and made them break it up so that they'd still not be a monopoly. But nonetheless, it don't matter if they're broke up in different names. Who owns all the different names? There's a industry war going on out there buying for control of everything under the sun. It doesn't matter. It's all about greed and whatever, finances. Yeah, let's put some more on there and see what else we got. Because, you know, at one point in history, you know, they said they were carrying around gasoline in buckets. They'd go there and get the gasoline, and then they'd haul it home and pour it in their vehicles. That sounds safe to me.
Serious problem. We have different gasoline standards for Montana. Pollution is not such a big issue. There are probably 55 different kinds of gasolines in the United States that are shipped around the country to different locations.
The gasoline sold in Montana and other low-pollution areas may produce more pollutants, but it's cheaper. This doesn't mean it's any lower quality. It's just not specially refined to burn cleaner than usual. Along with the varying standards, refiners also have to make summer and winter versions of all these different formulas, since outside temperatures can affect how gasoline vaporizes and the amount of pollution released. All of these different versions, combined with the huge cost of refining equipment and the pressure to keep gasoline prices low, add up to very tight economies.
You have so much money invested in the plants, such high-tech equipment, but you need to keep them running 24 hours a day to get your return.
Yeah, and that's why they went to the petrodollar, folks. It's all based on oil. That's why they're afraid of you.
Running nonstop large refineries used to require several thousand workers. But due to computerization, only about 600 people per shift are needed today. The sophisticated units that produce millions of gallons of gasoline every day can be monitored from one or two control rooms. Other workers use bicycles, golf carts, and trucks to move around and perform all of the tough work. Out here, safety is the number one priority.
You were growing up in the refining country. It was not uncommon to have classmates whose dad had been killed in refinery explosions. It was just a fact of life. Things have really changed dramatically since then.
But despite all of the costs and complexities of making gasoline, the job is only half done. Next, the amazing infrastructure, 100 years in the building, that moves gasoline to the marketplace. Refinery maintenance is usually done in the spring before the summer driving season. At that time, the number of workers can suddenly triple. Long before high-tech tanker trucks did the job, at the dawn of the 20th century, horse-drawn wagons with wooden containers transported gasoline from refineries. They delivered fuel to general stores, where it was sold by the bucket.
You brought it back to your house and filled up your car. They tried a delivery system where they had wagons deliver the...
That's what I was saying. You fill the bucket up and you take and carry it back to your car. Yeah, there you go.
Gasoline to your house, but they found they blew up too often, and it was too dangerous a way to distribute gasoline.
To reduce gasoline's exposure to sparks and flames out in the open, especially near people's homes, Sylvanus Bowser of Fort Wayne, Indiana, adapted his oil pump for gasoline use in 1905. Soon after that, primitive filling stations hooked up curbside pumps where people could fuel their cars in the street. But as the number of cars grew, congestion became a problem. So in 1913, the first real drive-in service station owned by the Gulf Corporation opened for business in Pittsburgh. By 1920, non-flammable metal tanks on trucks and special railroad tanker cars provided more protection during delivery.
All right, let me pause for a second for a little bit more ridiculousness. Alright, back in World War I and World War II, they made wood gasifiers that essentially took and heated up a container full of wood and gasified the wood to actually turn that carbon-based wood into fuel to run the doggone trucks and stuff, and it worked out pretty well. So when these folks are talking about carrying gasoline in a bucket and how they have a they get blown up and all that kind of stuff, it just kind of it dawned on me. What's to stop somebody from using the doggone same process of wood gasification to literally turn oil on demand into fuel that would run your vehicle? Yeah, there's a link that I posted inside the chat room down there where this man over in the, I can't even remember where the heck he was at from now. But nonetheless, he took gasoline and regular gasoline and distilled it to make Coleman fuel so that he could burn in his lantern, because you can't burn all them additives in your lantern because it'll crud up your lantern and your lantern won't work right. But nonetheless, you can see what all the impurities were at the bottom of all that kind of stuff, all the additives. And so, what would stop anybody from making a system that would literally distill the fuel on demand, knowing that all you really seriously needed was a little bit of vaporization, and that fuel would work more efficient than anything else out there? So you could literally turn your cruddy old oil that you burn in, that you use to keep your engine lubricated, and because of the poorly designed ring system of the modern day internal combustion engines, you get a blow by past the rings because they're not completely sealed. The blow by works its way down, and all the black carbon and soot gets down inside your doggone oil, and that's why you have to have an oil filter to basically clean that oil up, because once that carbon gets down into the oil, that carbon will literally act as sandpaper inside the oil against your rings and pistons and all your different moving parts and your bearings, and it'll literally start tearing stuff up if you don't have a filter to take out that crud before your oil's recirculated. But at some point, your oil can't be cleaned up enough by the doggone oil filter, and so you end up having to get an oil change. They recommend you change your oil over so many miles or whatever, because no matter how hard that filter tries, it just can't take away all that carbon. And so if it was done properly from the get-go, you wouldn't even have carbon blow by. Your oil would never have to change. You would never even have to worry about your parts going bad. But nonetheless, let's just say you decide to keep it that way anyway, because if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You could turn that doggone fuel, or that old waste oil, into new fuel to run the same vehicle. You could build a supplementary system that would distill that on demand, and since all you needed was a vapor of fuel, and you could do it. You know, they did it with wood gasifiers. They burn wood gasifiers and make that engine run off of the gas that was created by wood gasifier. So, man, I'm telling you what. Common sense, it went out the window with the invention of brass knuckles and or the pogo stick. That's all there is to it. There ain't no common sense. Basic sciences went by the wayside. Sciences went into some voodoo version of telling you what kind of planets and what kind of materials are on planets that are millions of light years away because of a little blink and a wobble. And they the color of the light that they get, they can tell you all this kind of stuff. Are you kidding me? They supposedly sent a probe all the way to Pluto, so far away that if you look back at the sun's just a little tiny dot in the sky, and it only gives off enough energy to potentially light up a 2-watt light bulb, yet they were able to use some material that would do a thermal reaction for 9 years. It traveled through space, got there, was able to produce 200 watts, enough to take a picture of Pluto, radio it all the way back through space, and be able to show you a picture of what Pluto looked like. Now see, either science is lying out the side of their neck, or we got some amazing technologies. And we could take and we could build a supercar that you could put a few quarts of oil down inside there instead of multiple gallons of gas, And there ain't no way you're going to blow that thing up because you don't have to worry about any gas vapor sloshing around in your tank. And if your car got hit, then you just make a mess and you'd mop it up and everything be fine. You know, you could still burn the so-called fossil fuels and be able to have just as much horsepower as you got today. And if it's properly engineered, you'll have even more horsepower than you got. There's a car out there called the Koenigsegg, and it's almost up to 300 miles an hour. And this car is a gas hybrid electric that has an electric transmission in there and is outperforming every other doggone vehicle on the market. It's bad to the bone. I'd love to have one. I just ain't got the funds to buy one. So whenever you guys want to bust your piggy banks open and pitch in, buy me a Koenigsegg and see if I can stay out of jail while I'm drag racing. Anyway, let's take this on down the road here a bit and see where we get.
Although fires from leaks were still fairly common, oil manufacturers have been using a safer transportation method for decades, moving product in pipelines. By the 1930s, refiners were transporting gasoline the same way.
A 20-inch pipeline carries about 150,000 barrels a day. That equates to about 750 trucks that would be on the road. And when you think in terms of that many trucks on the road, there are issues with regard to safety, there are issues with regard to cost. The price of gasoline would be almost doubled, if not more. Pipeline is the most safe and efficient way of transporting barrels throughout the United States.
By 1956, there were over 36,000 miles of pipelines for gasoline.
Yeah, 36,000 miles of pipeline. That means if we have an earthquake in between here and there, or something goes awry, then you got one heck of a mess in your yard. Look, we got this nifty technology called induction heating. And you can build this little circuit in the coil, and you can put a piece of metal in between that coil. And it uses known technologies, known physics to literally, when you put power to that, cause that metal to get red hot. I mean, you could actually melt metal inside that field. Now imagine if you took that same induction heating technology and you had a container that you would put a metal rod inside of, and then you also take your oil and you pour it right down in there with that metal rod. Well, when you hit that induction heating, it would heat that metal rod up, which would heat the oil inside up there, which would start to vaporize gas, that basically gasify that oil right straight into a fuel source. And so that's just one little tiny crude example of what could actually be accomplished with the known science that we've got today. And people want to know why OSHA's is has a wild hairdo. I'm about to pull my hair out because these people are going off the rails with stupidity. It's driving me insane. You know, you can't be that ignorant. It's not possible to be that ignorant, literally. And we got the technology to literally build an engine, internal combustion engine, that will run off of pure distilled water, and you got the best mechanics in the world sitting out there trying to argue the laws of thermodynamics to disprove any possibility of you being able to do that. That's because they didn't pay attention in science class. Alright, and I'm telling you that we could take and we could design a fuel system that you wouldn't even have to have a fuel refinery. You could literally refine the fuel on demand, and you could run that same type of fuel right inside your system and get a cleaner burn with no carbon blow-by that wouldn't go and cause your oil in your vehicle to get black and cruddy, and then your oil filter finally chugs up and you can't get no oil circulating through there and everything grinds to a screeching halt and you got to go out and pay thousands of dollars and get your engine repaired or buy you a new one. You know, it's planned obsolescence. It's planned ignorance is what it is, because this industry's been around all these years and the technology available are right there in front of your very eyes to literally build the perfect running machines. I mean, machines that will last for hundreds, if not thousands of years. The simple of it is, if nothing reaches its thermal breakdown, it will not fail. And if you understand anything about basic physics and science, then you can understand that when you get to this certain point, the engine or whatever will get hot enough that the weakest point in the deal will get too hot and it will begin to fail. But if you never allow it to get to that point, and if you're getting a clean burn every single time, you raise your efficiency level up so incredibly high that you barely even have to use any fuel. That's the whole key. But, doggone it, don't listen to me. I'm just a guy that, paid attention in science class. These other knuckleheads, I don't know what the heck they were thinking, and they're going to sit there and tell you, oh, well, we got to cut back on fuel because it's scarce, and we got to charge you some more money for this. And then at the other side of their neck, they're laughing all the way to the bank because they're making money hand over fist. They don't care about nature. They don't care about the environment, you know. They don't care about nothing but the bottom dollar, you know, the how thick they can get their wallet. That's as simple as that. And all these miles and miles and miles of oil pipes, and even in some instances having to steal up people's land to put these pipes through, or, you know, force them to sell some rights to let them cross their property. You know, and it's not even necessary because you could build an engine, you could build an automobile that you could literally refine the oil on the fly. I mean, think about it, people. Come on. An average engine runs 160 to 180 to 220 degrees Fahrenheit. There are parts inside that engine that are screaming hot. And heat is what you need to refine the oil. And so you can literally turn your oil into fuel. And if you think I'm wrong, go out there and get your car, get it started, and let it get up to operating temperature and taking drips and fuel down on your exhaust system, and tell me if it didn't catch fire on you. Alright? Basic science, basic common sense, that's what we're up against. We're up against a system out there that is set into place that is making money hand over fist, and that does not want to move into the future, because if we move into the future and these technologies are actually in the average Joe's hands, this knowledge would put the average Joe in a position of not having to be at the mercy of the electric company, not having to be at the mercy of the power company or the fuel industries and all that kind of stuff. Seriously. You know, they got waste oil burners that are making amazing leaps as far as how much heat that they can actually produce. But those waste oil burners could actually be gone even farther. You could literally take cruddy oil and refine it on demand and take this oil and run your gasoline generators with it and never have to buy any doggone fuel. People were running around getting oil out of old French fry machines and they were making biodiesel out of it. The world is full of carbon-based. That world is a carbon-based world. And so anything that, you know, it falls off the tree, it's being recycled into the system, that's fuel. You burn your doggone firewood, it doesn't just give you heat, but it makes more fuel. That their own laws of physics done poked them in the eyeball, because they said that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, so where does it go? That firewood just made more products. That's all it did. Dad, burn it. I swear, I just want to scream sometimes. Anyway, let's move along here. We're in the middle where it's a pipeline. They're actually putting a pipeline down through here.
Even America. Today, there are more than 150,000 miles of these pipelines beneath our feet. Pump stations located every 50 miles or so keep the fuel moving. Before computers, workers separated different products inside pipelines using small plungers, known as pigs. Their name came from the fact that they would make a squealing sound as they moved through the pipes. And they're still used today for cleaning.
This is a pipeline pig. This is a cleaning pig. This is 4 inch in diameter, and these things come in various different sizes, as big as 60 inches in diameter. This actually travels along in the flow of the product. These cups are drive cups, so so the fluid actually pushes the pig along the pipeline.
Pipeline engineers have also developed smart pigs by attaching sophisticated electronic sensors to extra long units. They don't squeal, but they do talk back to the controllers, telling them exactly where cracks may be developing, so repairs can be made before a problem.
See, now I don't know if y'all caught that, but there's these things they call pipeline pigs. Alright, it's like a plunger that you stick down inside the pipe and the pressure behind it forces this thing down and it cleans the pipe along the way. Well, now they got a modern day version of a pipeline pig that you can actually send down there and it will inspect the pipe all the way down and it'll send the information back to the people and tell them where they need to repair, you know, now all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you got to send all this stuff down here constantly and They're sending multiple fuels down the same exact pipe, and every once in a while, gotta send this pig down there to clean the doggone thing up. The pig talks back to him and tells him what's what. But you know, there's a whole lot more technology going on into this system than meets the eye, you know. And looking like I got somebody trying to say hi. anyway. The thing is, there's so much involved in that pipeline. You're talking thousands of jobs, and during certain parts of the year, like during winter time or before winter time or spring or whatever, best times of the year, they'll basically they said they'll triple their employees so that they can I guess they'll be seasonal then, so that they can make all repairs necessary. And so you think about that. Think about all the different products that are made from crude oil and different types of fuels that are made from the same different deal, and all the different people that are working in the fuel industry. Man, that's why they don't like free energy. That's why they have idiots out there arguing the laws of thermodynamics, which... Okay, now brace yourself. Everybody sit back and brace yourself, because what I'm fixing to say is going to blow your doors off. When you're talking about free energy, the laws of thermodynamics do not apply. Period. And so if I'm trying to tell you how to build an engine that runs off of pure distilled water, or how to build a self-oil refinery engine that would actually make your fuel on demand, don't try to argue with me about the laws of thermodynamics, which are essentially set there to say that perpetual motion is not possible. Not trying to get perpetual motion, just trying to get maximum efficiency and using basic science and physics to do it. Whereas the alternative is to let the status quo of what's going on out there be the ridiculousness that sets the standard for all the different crazy stuff, the prices and, the whole carbon emissions thing. it's going to give me an aneurysm. Anyway... The technology is on the table. If average Joe decides to get their act together and basically beat the system at their own game, I get trolls that come out on my YouTube channel telling me how stupid I am. I get people get mad at me because I argue about current watts and amps, and I get people trying to argue with me about laws of thermodynamics and such. And, it's just that it's not that they don't, they ain't educated. They are educated. They're seriously indoctrinated. They can't think outside the box because the book says, and that's all that matters is what the book says. It doesn't matter what basic science said years ago whenever they were taught real science. So, modern day science has turned into some sort of a cult religion of making stuff up as you go, and if the theory doesn't, pan out well, then you just add another reason why this is the case or whatever, but the real science, when you look at somebody back in World War I or World War II building a wood gasifier and running an internal combustion engine on it, then that's one process, that's one piece of the puzzle. And then you understand that the oil is a carbon base, And so that's basically what they're using when they throw wood inside that gasifier. There ain't no reason why you couldn't gasify a quart of oil and make gasoline on demand. You don't even need to get it to be in the liquid state. You could actually just use the gas off of it, vaporize it, send it into the combustion chamber in the proper quantities necessary. The harder you step down on that gas pedal, when you drop the pedal to the metal, so to speak, the less fuel you're going to use and the better burn you're going to get. So there wouldn't even be no carbon emissions out the back, because you're getting a clean burn every doggone time. And even if you did get some out the back, who cares? The plants love it. That's what I'm saying. But no, we got to put up with all this craziness. We got to put up with the trolls and the naysayers and the governments trying to give us taxes on everything under the sun. That's a, you know, another key to the whole mess is that the doggone government, they don't want to get rid of the fuel taxes because it gives them money to go out to war and do whatever else they want to do. But if the average Joe took a look at the big picture and all the pieces of the puzzle and realized, hey, if you can do that with wood and you can do that with oil and you can actually use hydrogen technology on demand and this is a way we can get free electricity and such, and they just, instead of trying to ask daddy for permission, they just build these machines themselves and do it, you'd be off the power grid so fast it'd make your head spin. You'd be off the power grid so fast it'd make their head spin. Everybody's head'd be spinning. It'd look like some sort of terrible version of The Exorcist. It'd be disgusting, man. I'll tell you what. But it's, you know, don't listen to me. I don't know what the heck I'm talking about. Get out there and Google it up, man. See this guy making Coleman fuel out of gasoline. You know, when I saw him putting it on the electric stove, I'm saying, well, that's not necessarily looking too safe. And then go Google up the guy that's vaporizing gas, and you see whenever he ignites that fuel, how clean of a uniform burn he got up out of that fuel right there. And all these backyard scientists, I give them more respect than the mainstream scientists, because they ain't sold their soul to the devil in order to be able to try to convince everybody this is the way it has to be, period. So, with that said, you know, let's get back to the deal here.
Curds. Gasoline and other products can now run continuously instead of shutting down to insert product separating pigs. Thanks to the computerized flow controls at a handful of traffic control centers. Here they keep the amount of mixing between products to a minimum.
We have what's called a batching system. We'll batch gasoline, we'll batch premium and regular, diesel fuel, jet fuel, etc. We don't put anything in between those. There is some commingling of the product, and that's put into what's called a transmix tank, and then that's sold to a different market.
Some of that mixture is sent back to refineries to be separated once again. The rest is sold to industries that can use any type of fuel to power their equipment. Pipelines are operated in one of two ways. 95% work as common carriers, and 5% are not.
Patty in the chat room said it best. She said energy dependence creates perpetual source of revenue and control, and that's all this is about. This is the reason why we're fighting so hard out here in the alternative energy community. You know, and that, look, I'm just, I gotta shut up. I'm just gonna play some more.
As dedicated. For instance, a pipeline running from a Chevron refinery to a Chevron terminal where Chevron trucks deliver gasoline to Chevron stations is a dedicated system. But the other 95% of pipelines, especially long ones running all the way from Houston to the upper Midwest or East Coast, are common carrier pipelines. Several companies buy time from the pipeline operator. This system leads to a very interesting fact that gasoline companies don't exactly volunteer to consumers. All gasoline is basically the same. Or as the industry says, fungible.
All right, there's the word for you. Fungible. 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 All right, that sounds crazy to me, but I don't know why they said it. But basically, it's just a fancy way to say that all gasoline, no matter what brand name's on it, is all the same. That's the secret. That's a dirty little secret of the fuel industry out there. All these different refineries sending the same fuel down the same doggone pipes, and, you know, basically everybody getting their piece of the pie. But when it finally gets to the pump, it don't matter what kind of fancy flag or banner it's under or what they're saying about it. It's the same exact fuel. The only difference may be the particular additives that they put inside there to either be detergents that clean your engine or whatever. But something that'll raise the octane level, which, well, I gotta repeat about earlier, octane is not a booster. Octane is essentially set there to ensure that you do not get premature detonation. That means the gas doesn't explode before you want it to. That's it. It's as simple as that. But when they say, oh, it's got high octane in it, no, that just means it's got an inhibitor to keep the fuel from burning too fast, and you get that pinion noise in your engine. And they say, I don't know what I'm talking about. All right, let's just keep on rolling here. This might get a little rowdy, I'm guessing.
A fancy word for generic.
When Shell puts in a barrel of gasoline in Houston, Texas, that barrel that Shell put in is not necessarily the same wet barrel that they'll get out in Chicago or some other location. But it is of the same specification required by all shippers. A shipper can put a barrel into our system at Baytown, Texas from a refinery today and take a barrel out of the system in the Midwest or Northeast on the same day. So they don't have to wait the 13-day transit time on our system.
In this shared pipeline system, one company's regular unleaded or super unleaded is the same as another's. The last chance companies have to put their personal stamp on gasoline is at the terminal by mixing in chemical additives.
There are the qualities that you want to make your particular product stand out. That's done by additives. And so there's enormous amount of research going into additives that will clean the engine, that will stop corrosion, that will reduce the amount of wear.
So, that's the key. It's all the same gas with their own independent little additives on there. And that's how they want to sell it to you. Oh, ours will make your engine run cleaner. Ours will reduce knocking. Ours will reduce corrosion. Blah, blah. It's the same doggone gas.
The only problem is that all of the chemical additives do basically those same few things, as well as boosting octane and lowering emissions. That means it's up to the marketing department to convince consumers that you can put a tiger in your tank or drive your engine clean if you use the right brand.
For a time, historically, there were dramatic differences produced by different refining processes. But as time passes, by the 60s, 70s, and on into the present, those differences get a lot less, so that most companies, while they would like to advertise how much better their gasoline is than their competitors, are selling essentially the same product.
The additives are stored separately at terminals. Pipelines from refineries feed directly into temporary gasoline tanks, capable of holding 50,000 gallons each. When a truck pulls up to what is known as the rack to be filled, pumps move the proper grade of gasoline out of the right storage tank and into the truck. The chemical additives kept in smaller tanks are put in at the last second, so mixtures can be precisely controlled.
Our trucks have a capacity of about 9,000 gallons. With the system that we have here with the pumps and our loading rack layout, we can load a truck in approximately 10 to 15 minutes. And that's from the time our driver pulls onto the rack and pulls off of the rack.
From there, the drivers are off to the service station. Each truck is separated into three or four compartments, so different grades of gasoline can be delivered to underground storage tanks. This incredibly efficient delivery system helps keep gasoline prices low. But if gasoline is to remain the fuel of choice, it's going to have to compete with emerging lower emission alternatives. Next, the future. Gasoline versus the alternatives. Large gasoline terminals can load 2 million gallons a day and operate 365 days a year. Today, gasoline is designed to produce less pollution than ever before. Special formulas of gasoline with reshaped molecules and catalytic converters on automobile exhaust systems both help cars run cleaner. But each gallon of gas still releases about 5 pounds of carbon and other pollutants into the atmosphere, mostly as invisible carbon dioxide gas.
There's no question that lower emissions is the focus of fuel development today. We've made great strides over the past 30 or 40 years, but the greatest challenge for gasoline in the future is to maintain its focus on reduced emissions.
Researchers are constantly testing different formulas of gasoline in engines under a variety of conditions to find the best combination of performance, reliability, and low emissions.
At the conclusion of a test, we will tear the engines down, take a look inside, weigh specific parts, for example, to measure different performance features, and then evaluate our product and how to make improvements on that product.
Besides being made cleaner, gasoline can also be mixed with other materials to reduce pollution. Combining gasoline with ethanol, an alcohol made from corn or other crops, is one way of slightly lowering emissions while also decreasing the overall consumption of gasoline. Cars in the Midwest already run on mixtures containing about 10 to 15% ethanol. But gasoline isn't the only current vehicle fuel that can be mixed with other products to lower emissions and reduce oil use. Diesel fuel can be combined with something known as biodiesel to achieve similar results.
Biodiesel is produced from living plants, such as soy, bean oil, and also can be produced from animal fat. Think of the grocery store, a bottle of general-purpose vegetable oil. It isn't the raw oil from crushing the seeds. The material has been processed and refined to make it into a product that we would use for cooking. And the same type improvement of the oil through refining makes it into a material that's suitable as a diesel fuel.
Since gasoline and diesel can both be mixed with lower emission materials made from renewable sources, it's hard to determine which combination makes more sense. The basic design of a diesel engine may eventually give that fuel the edge. The biggest difference is that diesel doesn't require a spark plug.
We squeeze the diesel fuel down to a smaller volume that generates more heat, and that heat is then able to ignite the diesel without a spark, because of the higher compression ratio.
Alrighty, so ignite the diesel without a spark because of higher compression. Compression ignition. Ain't no reason why you couldn't do the same doggone thing without having to have any kind of octane boosters or additives in the internal combustion engine. You could just move where your timing point was, where the engine would detonate on when you wanted it to. Patty said in the chat room, the use of oil for fuel and energy is one of the most inefficient ways to produce energy, yet is the most widely used and most widely accepted. The oil companies are and have been the largest corporate structure in the world since the 1800s. No new innovations in energy, only in the processing. Even supposed clean energy systems such as electric cars are still dependent on oil for operation. This makes no sense. We can dissect the genome, create life in a petri dish, design robotic for every niche, yet we cannot cut the tether from oil. The main culprit for the toxins and pollutants in our food, water, and soil. Where is the intelligence in this? Why do we continue to support and buy the package of a dependence of this antiquated and purposefully integrated fuel source? Where is the real science in energy production? It's here at Mad Science. I got to sneeze. Achoo! Yeah, there was a lot of power in that one. Alright, so essentially we're up against a system that is it so embedded into the buttocks of the humanity like a tick And to try to dig that out, it's going to be like, it's going to be a chore. And what I'm saying here is, even if you wanted to remain on the so-called fossil fuels, there are methods by which you can actually make this fuel so incredibly efficient that you're barely burning, you barely have any type of exhaust whatsoever, if any at all. And the technology is already there. Hydrogen technology, already there. And like I said, that Koenigsegg that was made, that's it's a gas electric hybrid, has electric transmission in there. That thing has a massive amount of torque and is outperforming all the other vehicles out there. And it's just one step. We could literally build supercars that would build, they would produce their fuel on the fly. Literally. And heck, if you wanted to, you could actually set it up to right now, to where when somebody else's car in front of you is smoking, you could just suck those fumes up into your system and use their waste fuel to run your doggone vehicle. You could store it up, drive through town cleaning up everybody's exhaust. It's, look, I know it sounds futuristic, sci-fi, but it's not. You know, if this crud is in the air, you can clean it up, you can burn it for fuel. That's all there is to it. And people are like, well, that ain't plausible. You're not going to suck up enough exhaust fumes to run your deal. Well, if you suck up enough exhaust fumes to give your engine more efficiency by taking away somebody else's waste product, and you use less fuel in the process, we're talking about efficiency here. We're not talking about you're going to drive down the road and pick your gasoline up out of the air or whatever, to the extent where you're going to fill your tank every quarter mile or anything like that. But if you can burn their exhaust, think about it. It's just, I don't know, it drives me nuts, man. Let's move on.
The diesel engine will be, on average, about 30% more efficient.
Biodiesel and ethanol can also power their respective engines entirely on their own, with only minor modifications. This would lower emissions even further and drastically reduce oil dependency. But these biofuels may be hard-pressed to meet the demand for a huge number of cars.
And most studies that I have seen suggests that the amount of cropland that required just exceeds the available cropland we have, even in a land-abundant country such as the United States.
Now you got to hear what the man just said. He said that the amount of cropland available out there to literally produce biofuel exceeds the number of cars or whatever in the United States. Look, that's stupid. Because all you're talking about is a carbon-based plant life system that you need to make in order to make biofuel. And we can do that with algae. We can actually use what I was talking about earlier, duckweed and watermill, something that will double itself in a day or so, and never run out of fuel. We could use the process by which somebody else, some farmer's over there making his crops and putting too much nutrients into the doggone crops to grow the plants big, and in that process the runoff is going in and causing our ponds to be so nutrient rich that duckweed and watermill can thrive if they don't have something to eat it up. And so in small amounts of area you can produce a massive, and I say a massive and I'm talking about a ludicrous size of massive amount of fuel that would be more than enough. You could turn every single potty pond in the entire United States into a fuel depot, literally, and never run out of fuel. So if people out there want to keep on arguing that there ain't no such thing as free energy, I'm just going to have to tell you that they're just actually trying to be intentionally ignorant, because they didn't pay attention in basic science. I'm sorry if that sounds rude, but that's a fact. You know, I don't call it mad science for nothing. Anyway, we're getting closer to the end of this. Let's play some more.
Since alternative gasoline and diesel mixtures still release pollution, the search continues for a true zero-emission answer. Electric cars don't pollute. But drivers can usually only drive about 100 miles before they have to stop to recharge. So gasoline still helps out, in the form of hybrid vehicles. These cars have two engines, internal combustion and electric. Hybrids are gaining wider acceptance as costs from a two-engine system begin to come down. Since less power is needed from the internal combustion engine, smaller, less wasteful models can be used. The electric motor does a lot of the work, and in most systems is recharged during normal driving by the power generated when the car brakes, or by the internal combustion engine if needed. Therefore, less gasoline is used. This means less pollutants are released into the atmosphere compared to cars powered solely by gasoline. Besides electric motors, fuel cells are another possible zero emissions alternative to gasoline powered engines. In order to eliminate any pollution, pure hydrogen must be fed into the fuel cell. A special membrane separates hydrogen electrons and protons. The electrons are forced to travel around the membrane. This movement creates electricity. Then they rejoin with the protons, and the hydrogen combines with available oxygen. In this case, the only exhaust is water. Truly, zero emissions. The problem is that pure hydrogen isn't so easy to come by.
Hydrogen is cited by many scientists as our most abundant element on Earth, which it is. But the hydrogen that exists on Earth is combined with other elements, primarily as a hydrocarbon or as water.
Pure hydrogen can be separated from other materials at special plants and is already being shipped to a small number of experimental hydrogen refilling stations. But it will take some time before pure hydrogen is available everywhere that gasoline is now.
When we drive around, we don't think about the network that moves gasoline to our cities.
All right, look. Stan Myers back in 1970s was driving around in a dune buggy on hydrogen technology, and they're talking about how it's all, well, we were going to have some trouble getting this all together and stuff. It took us a long time to get the gasoline pipes and everything, all that infrastructure into place. It's going to take us quite some time to get the other in place. Don't give me that, folks. If they wanted to do this, it'd have done been done. The only reason why they have experimental hydrogen fueling stations out there is for the fact that whenever it does come to the point where people decide to force the industry into alternative fuel sources, that they're still going to have control. That's it. That's the whole thing. It ain't that we don't have hydrogen technology ready to go. It's that they want to make sure that whenever you stop buying their gasoline and start buying hydrogen, they still own the farm. They still own the business. They still own the company. They still own everything. All the rights, all of it. That's the way it works. It's a control factor. They want your dollar. They want your compliance. They want you to be their customer, nobody else's customer. They don't want you self-contained. They don't want you knowing that you can go outside and pick some sticks up out of the ground that done fell off the tree, not even harming nature, none whatsoever, and then turn that into gas that you could actually run an internal combustion engine on, just like they did back in World War I and II when they were running low on fuel. They don't want you to know you can turn algae into biofuel, that you could run diesel engines. They don't want you to know that you could run an engine on water. Now, when I say run an engine on water, you got to have it separated, crack the hydrogen and oxygen in order to do so. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that you could do it properly. It was done back in the 70s. But nonetheless, there are better, more efficient manners by which you could engineer an engine to specifically, that's the key, specifically run off of pure distilled water. And so for all those folks out there listening in on the mechanic side who think you know everything there is to know about engine and compression and mathematics and all that kind of stuff and physics or whatever, and you want to sit there and try to start arguing the laws of thermodynamics with me, you need to stop misquoting the laws of thermodynamics. You need to go back and read between the lines and read exactly what it says and find a better understanding of the laws of thermodynamics, which are merely there to say that a closed loop system cannot work, and it basically there to disprove perpetual motion. Man. So, with that said, let's try to see what else is left on here, because they're saying some goodies.
When people talk about moving to the hydrogen economy, for example, that would require us to start all over again from scratch.
So just as in hybrid electric cars.
See, that's what you just said. That'll cause us to have to move over again from scratch. No, we don't got to go back to scratch. You could use the same doggone crazy infrastructure that you got in place already to move over to hydrogen. You can give somebody the option. Well, you want to run your car on hydrogen? You might need this adapter to your engine or whatever, you know. But the infrastructure, as far as, you know, the way it's all set up, you know, it's set up to run, fuel through pipes is it. You know, bring the crude oil over. Get it warm, pressurize it, separate it into different deals that you can use for all different types of products, and then pipe it down the deal. What's the big deal? It's still got hydrocarbons in it. Are you serious? yeah, okay, let's go.
Gasoline is sneaking into the fuel cell scenario, since it contains a lot of hydrogen. Powering fuel cells with a hydrogen found in gasoline would still produce some emissions. But since fuel cells are much more efficient than internal combustion engines, you'll be able to go a lot farther on that gallon of gas. An alternative that wouldn't require any infrastructure is solar power. It can already propel light research vehicles and may be used in the near future to provide part of a car's power. But it will be some time before researchers can squeeze enough horsepower from solar cells.
That's a doggone lie. That is a flat out, blatant, irrefutable lie. It'll be some time before we can squeeze out enough horsepower out of solar panels. Dad burned idiots, just like fuel, any type of fuel. It don't matter what type of fuel. Electricity's a fuel. It don't matter what type of fuel. If you're using it to its maximum efficiency and you're not trying to turn, if you're not trying to get a mouse to pull a wagon, this makes my eyes crooked, man. You can get enough horsepower out of electric vehicles. Electric vehicles, DC power has a lot of torque. All you got to do is convert that current inside that solar panel to DC. And if used properly, you can pressurize supercapacitor banks that basically would keep any type of battery you want fully charged. In reality, you don't even really need a battery. You could turn the solar panel system into literally a solar panel hybrid capacitor bank that would send out a punch that would blow your doors off. It's not that we don't have enough energy, folks. It's just that these people just refuse to use it to its efficiency. That's the problem. It's not being used right. Patty said the problem is they know that if they move away from oil and the processing needed to create fuel, that they will lose the ability to control energy. Anyone who able to produce energy from other sources, they have to maintain control. And that's what, that's why Theodore Roosevelt, I think Teddy Roosevelt, that's why he had to break up the monopoly of the Rockefellers, because they wanted to control all the power, well, as far as all the fuel industry back then. And then they separated into a bunch of other ones that had been battling for power all along. And if anybody comes across with a better way, they want to buy it up, shut it down, suppress it. That's not a conspiracy. That's a fact. That's how they protect their corporate interests. That's how they protect their investors. That's how they protect their money, by taking any good idea off the table until you sell all your iPhone 5s. You don't want everybody knowing the iPhone 6 is ready. You see what I mean? Because if you got a bunch of iPhone 5s in the doggone warehouse, and you sell the iPhone 6, which is a better one, then you ain't going to be able to sell the 5s, because who's going to buy the 5 when the 6 is better for the same price? And the same doggone thing's going to apply with the oil industry out there and the electrical industry, is that they got to sell their product. They got tons and tons of gasoline and oil, you know, in warehouses and tanks and tankers on the way and so on and so forth and down in the ground. And they want to sell all that before they get to the point where you can run it on anything else but that. It's basic business, folks. And so for the average Joe to ever get out from underneath the thumb of the power industries out there and the fuel industries, the average Joe has going to have to be smarter than the average bear. You're going to have to start taking all these pieces of the puzzle that I've been laying out on the table for years and other people have been putting out on the table. The information is right there. When the average Joe is ready to take the true power of energy and utilize it to benefit all of humanity, there shouldn't be no third world countries that can't afford to have no electric, you know, or fresh water, all that kind of stuff. We got so much technology and overabundance of every resource under the sun, and yet we're going to sit around and argue about scarcity? Uh-uh. And don't tell me we got to grow 20,000 million acres of corn in order to make biofuel whenever everybody's pond is all green and with crud of duckweed and watermill because the farmer's over fertilizing his land, and that runoff is basically making biofuel in your doggone pond. All right, so if you take that biofuel and you run your generators off of biofuel that you've made out of that crud, now you ain't never going to run out of fuel, and your fish ain't never going to run out of food. It's as simple as that. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. That's what they said. That's what they said. Not me. I didn't say that. They said that. And so where's it go? It gets redistributed into more products. Nature does what nature does with things. Nature, you can't improve on nature. Only an ignorant person would believe that you're better than nature. That's all there is to it. And when it comes down to science, you want to know why I call it mad science? I'm sitting here and I'm telling you why I call it mad science. Just in the fuel industry alone, we're seeing some epic ridiculousness. It's just beyond ignorance. You know, this whole carbon emissions thing is the biggest scam in all scams out there. It's one of the major hawks of hooies of all hawks of hooies in the history of time. And once you've got a basic understanding that all of life out here is a carbon-based and lots of water, hydrogen. Hydrogen, one of the most abundant molecules, is a fuel source. Oxygen is the way that fuel source can burn. It doesn't matter. I mean, look, anything out there properly utilized, you could engineer an engine to run on cornflakes if you wanted to. Doggone it. When is this world going to get their act together? Let me see what else they got to say to get me riled up. I'm going to make my hair fall out, man. I'm going to be bald-headed.
To fuel a heavy consumer car. Since the more immediately viable electric and fuel cell options still involve the use of gasoline, it seems this familiar fuel will be with us for some time. Gasoline has come a long way in 100 years, and apparently still has a long way to go.
We've thoroughly adopted gasoline as a fundamental part of our economy, the fundamental driving force in our transportation system. What happens in the future will depend greatly on continuous technological advances and competing processes.
The fuel race is on. Gasoline will keep getting cleaner. However, it seems likely that other fuels will eventually overcome their technical limitations or supply problems to surpass it. But in today's world, gasoline still reigns supreme.
Alright, well, there you go. That's the end of that podcast. Gasoline will reign supreme. You heard it right there. Right there, you heard it. That's what they said. That's what they said. The gasoline will reign supreme. Well, if that's the way you want it, all right, people. We'll just keep on doing what we do here at Mad Science. We'll keep on ranting and raving about lack of common sense and why it is that we can't get our act together. We should have super machines right now. I mean machines of epic proportions that would just boggle your mind at their capabilities. Imagine driving up to your house and backing your bumper up to a specific link to your house, and now you just leave your car running and go inside, and your car is now your power source for your house. And with that said, there's one other thing I want to point out. Look at a hybrid electric. A hybrid electric engine basically has a gasoline portion or a diesel portion that runs a generator that runs the electric motors of your car. Now, if you look at the average weight of that vehicle, and then you think about how much torque it actually turns to turn a generator head that would, put out, let's say, 10,000 to 12,000 watts of power continuous. If you took that body of that car off and you just used the hybrid electric portion of the deal, you could run your generator part-time, use that engine and the charging system in that engine to charge up battery banks. And so essentially what would be going on here is every so often the gasoline engine would kick itself on and it would charge up a big massive battery bank that was running inverters that would run your doggone house. All right. Well, there was a company out there that figured that out. They're called Generac. They have these generators that are basically there to, in case your power goes out, it will instantaneously see that the power just went out of your house. It will start up either using propane or gas or diesel. It will start up a generator that will put the power back to your house. Now, it's already been done to some extent. It just hasn't been improved on to the maximum efficiency to where, you could run this 24/7. You could literally take some bit of information from a Back to the Future where the guy comes in his Back to the Future car, his DeLorean, and he gets out and he starts digging in the trash and putting this trash down into Mr. Fusion and making fuel so that they can go back to the future again. Well, ain't this not beyond the realms of possibility, because all that stuff that you threw away, guess what? It's got carbon in it too. It's fuel. And so you can turn your trash into fuel. Everybody's got to eat. Everybody makes waste because you get the paper and plastics in your grocery store that are carrying your food in the containers. You can turn those containers into fuel. And so everything, there wouldn't even be no landfills anymore. You could take your trash from whatever, have your trash can directly send right straight down a chute into a fuel tank that now would break all that stuff down and turn it into fuel to run your home generating system that would power your house from here till whenever. And Stephen said, you should work for Rockefeller Research Department. I'm sure they pay well. Manufactured ignorance is rampant in current energy systems. I agree, Patty. Man, you'd think they'd want to get rid of a guy like me, but I don't think they're so worried about a guy like me, because the things that I'm saying sound so fantastic that the average Joe don't think it's possible. That's because they really didn't pay attention in science class. And if they did pay attention in science class, then they would understand what I'm saying doesn't defy any known laws of physics. And it's all based on scientific proven technology that's already on the store shelves right in front of their face. You know? And just because you've been told by the industry that you have to have this massive solar array to run your house doesn't make it true. It just means they want to sell you more solar panels. takes you so many watts in order to charge the battery to keep up. But if look, here's the thing about science. If you got anything in this world that's getting hot, then that means the process is not working right. Alright, if it's generating heat because of friction, that means there's resistance. And if there's resistance, that means there's room for improvement. And so you could turn around and redesign, re-engineer, utilize the energy in a completely different fashion and not generate that heat, not destroy your batteries or your components inside your inverters and such. There's got to be some people out there in the world that know what I'm saying. I'm sure the mainstream industry knows it. I'm even positive that the mainstream science knows that there's a better way, but they got to figure a way around the system, because you don't want to interfere with the tax base. You don't want to interfere with the job base. You don't want to interfere with the industry's money-making scheme, is what I want to call it, scam. Craziness. You know, it don't take as near as much fuel to run your car as you think it does. But if your car is only 20 some odd percent or even 36% efficient, then that leaves a whole lot of room for improvement. And if that engine was properly engineered, then you would have a better running engine, a longer lasting engine, and we would have a lot cleaner air to breathe. I don't know, maybe I'm just crazy. Look, I posted a picture inside the chat room. I'll go ahead and try to repost it again. Take a look at this t-shirt that I put together. I'm really seriously contemplating on trying to find the best price to share this with people. And you know, I'm not really necessarily going to try to do it for making a profit or anything, but maybe to help, in research or something like that, make a few pennies on it. I must have pushed the wrong button there. Come on, man, give me a break. Anyway, let me try this again. Do that. For some doggone reason, I swear.
Sure again.
Uh-oh. That's
well.
Weird. I gotta shut that down.
It's not beyond the realms of possibility.
Yeah, there we go. So, anyway, I'm trying to post that doggone link and get it in there. For some reason, it ain't allowing me to. Doggone it. It'll drive me to drink it. Let's put it on a different computer then. You know, between Microsoft and all the other big companies that want to make sure that they're the only ones you buy from, and they get the softwares all it just doesn't work. You try to mix this with that and you get a doggone mess, man. Why can't they ever leave well enough alone? Skype jacks up on you and freezes on you. Chat rooms are messed up because you got your doggone virus program trying to shut things off and not allow you to do things, and then you got Google trying to say you can't go to this site because it ain't safe, which is a crock. It's a hockahoo, you know, Shaziz Radio. We don't. That, see, now it goes. I got to delete one of those. Oh, man. Anyway. They try to do all this kind of stuff to keep control over everything. They want control over the knowledge, net neutrality, and all that kind of stuff. If we're going to get this done, we're going to have to do it quickly. We're going to have to do it by ourselves, because there ain't no way you're going to get any of these people to cooperate. They want to make money off of you. They want to spy on you. They want to know what you're interested in so they can sell to you. The industries out there, fuel industries, electrical companies and all that kind of stuff. Anyone's got anything to do with power, they want to be able to make money off of you, period. They want to keep control over everything, and that's as simple as that. That's how they make money. It ain't got nothing to do with they don't know how to make things efficient. They don't want to make things efficient. If you got a whole entire house that'll run off a few watts of power, you ain't going to make much money selling electricity, because average Joe throw up 140-watt solar panel and run his whole doggone house. And so how are you going to sell electricity to that person? No, you want to sell them these energy-compliant, Energy Star products that's going to use up more doggone electricity than necessary to run it, so you can still keep that doggone meter spinning like a top. That's why they put smart meters in there. Wasn't so they can make the doggone planet any better. It's just so they got to figure out a better way to charge you more money. Make sure you ain't stealing no electricity. Doggone jerks. Hey, anybody want to call in and give me a breather? Talk and raise a ruckus? Just raise your hand and say aye and I'll drag you into the call, man. I done went on for all this time trying to tell the world. You know, I got to looking around out there in the alternative energy, and I found a lot of stuff. And even I got to looking even at other communities, alternative energy communities, conspiracy communities, and even the flat earth versus the ball earth communities. And I honestly believe that there's so many doggone people out there trolling each other. That's the whole deal. If you can troll the heck out of each other and keep people arguing over stupid stuff all this time, that's probably what the whole flat earth and the ball earth debate's all about, is to keep people distracted away from the real truth. Stephen Gibbons says, why is the truth the key to free energy? Shaziz, have you created a motor that runs on truth and honesty? Well, yeah, I'd say that. I don't see why we have a whole economy that runs on lies and dishonesty. Boy, I tell you what, if you could bottle that up and sell it, man, that's an abundant resource these days. So, anyway, let me see. Somebody come on in the Mad Science Room and throw a thumb up and join me on air here for the last 30 minutes of the show. I need a second brain in here. Anyway, look, mad science is the key to free energy. And the reason why I say mad science is the key to the truth about free energy is because mad science is real science. It's actually doing some tests. That's what I do all the time. Before I say something ain't going to work and whatever, I will actually try it. And I'll see if it's going to work or it ain't going to work. And so I'm not going to sit out here and tell people something I can't prove. That'd make me look like a fool. But, you know, in order to, to find out about the truth about free energy, you got to use mad science. You got to get mad. You got to run through the window like the guy said in one deal and shout out the window, we ain't going to take it anymore. Because you're going to teach me one thing in school back in the day, and then as I'm getting older in life and having to watch and see what you're teaching everybody else out there, they don't jive. NASA, if you send a probe all the way to Pluto, you got some really impressive technology that could solve the whole so-called energy crisis overnight. And yet you're not doing it. And if NASA's spending over 50 some odd million dollars a day, and we're giving them that kind of money, that's a lot of money. That's a heck of a lot of money per day. Alright? And if they're getting that kind of money per day, could you imagine what an alternative energy researcher like myself could do with that kind of funds in order to benefit the world? Let's see. Steve said, yeah, new glitch in the chat. If you want to paste a link, cut off the chat box anywhere on the page, then click back to the chat box and it will post. Cool. Alright, so it's just man, my head is it's just like ready to explode when I see all the things that NASA proclaims that they had and they have done. And then I listen to the basic physics and the basic science of everything. And then I pose my question in their forums, And the NASA groupies come running out of the woodworks immediately to try to tell me how stupid I am. And they don't even know who I am. Tell me how stupid I am. Look at you. I'm going to join Raymond in here. All right. Let's see. Call. Skype call. All right. You're live, brother. So am I. I can hear myself echo in the background. How you doing? You must be having microphone troubles. He'll figure it out. But anyway, until he gets it figured out, I'll just keep on saying something like that. We got every bit of information necessary to literally produce some perfectly engineered, incredible machinery that will last for decades. You know, I got some engines that are still running from way back in the old 1800s, man. And these engines are still sturdy. I see you. I see you waving. I just don't hear you yet. Anyway, the technology is on the table. And when you got a puzzle, the only deal is you take that puzzle, you put it down there, you match the shapes up, you see what this one does and what that one does, and you fit them together. And that's what I've been trying to point out forever and a day. I can hear you now, Raymond. How's it going?
All right. I just put my headset in because I got so much noise going on over here, and I don't want the background noise to interfere with the show, because I've been sitting here listening to it for over an hour and a half, and you caught up some really good stuff, son. Really good stuff. I mean, you know, just goofing around when I was younger and lived in North Carolina, I used to experiment with all kinds of different types of fuels in my automobile. I had an old Nash Rambler, and it was a six-cylinder flathead, and I'd run that thing on, I mean, you name it, paint thinner, lacquer thinner, kerosene, diesel fuel, coal oil, gasoline, propane, acetylene. Daggum, man. It's unreal.
Well, that's the thing, Raymond. It's like we live in a carbon-based world. Everything is fuel. Everything is energy. And yet we got people that really want to seriously argue the fact that there ain't no such thing as free energy, and it drives me nuts.
You know, here's the thing. You mentioned something about, or they said something about on that podcast you had, that there's not enough land in the United States to grow enough corn to make diesel fuel. Well, I mean, hey, forget the corn. What about all the sweet corn?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they don't make alcohol out of corn. They turn the starch in the corn into sugar, and then they make that into alcohol.
Yeah.
Well, the corn stalks are full of pure sugar, not starch.
Huh.
I mean, there's more sugar in the corn stalk and the leaves than there is in all the ears of corn on the stalk. I mean, but the thing is, you've eliminated one whole entire process. You don't have to turn the starch into sugar.
Yeah.
It's already sugar. And as far as that goes, what about sugar cane, sugar beets? I mean, daggum, man.
Well, that's it. There are so many different options available out there, and it's like, when you start talking to the average Joe about this, they're like, well, you know, if this was possible, why ain't they doing it? And I'm trying to tell them, look, they don't want to do it because it costs them money, and it's if you're not their customer anymore, if you can
I don't know if my figures are correct or not. If they're not, would somebody please correct me? But I read somewhere that the best they ever get is 18 to 20 gallons of alcohol per acre of corn. Duh! Holy cow, are you kidding me? I mean, a tenth of an acre in algae produces 100 gallons a week.
Huh. Yeah, and like we talked about the old water mill and duckweed and pond scum and algae problems out going out there because the farmers over-fertilizing their field and such. And the runoff is basically, you know, putting your pond to such high nutrients that this stuff overtakes your pond and it essentially takes out the sunlight and the fish.
One more thing. Who started this bull crap about biodiesel anyway?
The hippies.
Just pure vegetable oil in the summertime will run your diesel engine.
Sure.
Come on. You know, there's no chemical additives you have to do. There's no process you have to do. Just filter it really good so it'll go through your injectors. Pour it in there on a warm day. If not, put a little heat in the tank. Just a little heat. Duh. I mean, biodiesel is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of.
Yep. Hey, Patty, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm here.
Yay. So what do you think about all this madness?
I think that we live in an insane world governed by insane people.
Oh, yeah.
And that the only people who have the right idea are the ones who are struggling right now just to get the word out, you know. us common people with no... We don't have any attachments to the profit-driven industry. We don't have any need to be part of the corporate lie system, which is really good. You know, we know, I said something earlier, since the 1800s, you know, we've been digging holes, pulling oil out, right?
Yep.
And finding ways to process it and to revamp it so that it can be used efficiently for energy.
Sure.
And we have yet to do that. In fact, we've made it more complicated.
You know, to get back to what I was talking about a minute ago, it just, I'm getting old. I'm getting senile, okay? I can't remember everything. But I told you back years ago when I was a young man living in North Carolina, I used to play around with running engines on different fuels. I did exactly what I told you a little while ago. I went to the store. I had an Oliver six-cylinder diesel farm tractor. I went to the store and bought a gallon of vegetable oil, drained the tank, made sure there was no diesel in there because it will coagulate, drained the tank, poured that gallon of diesel fuel in it, fired that sucker up, and went right out in my field, started plowing and planting tomatoes.
Well,
I mean, pure diesel fuel, no biodiesel bull crap.
Well, let me put something else out there on the table. There's a lot of, you know, even in the farming industry and even in the food industry, that's one of the things that frustrates the heck out of me in seeing how many of the actual food industries waste so much food that could be a benefit to somebody because they can't sell it fast enough to get it out there. But nonetheless, you could turn that doggone waste from all the farms into fuel. Look. How many times I gotta say this? Everything on this planet is fuel, you know?
Yes, yes. Hey, what about, okay, your corn and soybean fields? They're collecting corn, they collect the soybeans, and what do? They plow the stalks under. No. You take it up, you put it in a big bin, you put water in it, anything organic.
Yeah.
If it rots underwater, produces, what is it?
Methane
gas. I mean, come on. So now all of a sudden during the wintertime, you got natural gas to heat your house and cook your food. And then come summer, now you have pure liquid fertilizer. Come on, man. Give me a break.
Well, that's the thing, man. If we wanted to literally use all the knowledge that we've gathered and we could get the right individuals out there to stop, you know, the hardest part is going to be able to pull the school book off the skulls of those who think themselves to be so highly educated that they have to go out there and try to degrade somebody for thinking outside the box. That's the hard part. Because,
you know,
hold on a second.
Talking about history books, okay? We need to pull a lot of books off the school shelf that are teaching lies or not teaching the truth. Maybe it's not a lie, but it's not the truth. For example, think about this a minute. Oh, Lord, I am getting senile. Lewis and Clark, they had a 40-man complement with them, right? Did you know that about one man had a firearm with him?
Well, I have no idea, man.
Wasn't they took
there.
Weapons. Huh. They were air pistols, I mean air rifles. They were air rifles. They held 800 PSI. You pumped it up by hand. Each rifle held 22 rounds. They were 46 caliber and would knock a man off completely off his feet at 200 yards. The school books don't teach you this stuff.
I didn't even know they had air rifles back then, but, you know, don't surprise me none.
The first air rifles ever invented were in the 1500s, and they were used mainly for hunting big boar and deer and elk. But then again, somebody else figured out, whoa, this is a good weapon to use in war, because it made no noise, and there was no flash at night, so that your enemy couldn't see where you were. There was no smoke. So you didn't have to take your Bowie knife and cut a hole in the smoke to see if you hit your target or not. I mean, the history books don't teach this stuff. Well, I'm 73 years old and I just now found out about it.
Let's hear what Patty got to think on this thing. So, you got anything that you think might be a possible solution out there to getting people to pay attention to what it is we're talking about, Patty?
Well, here's the real rub of it all, is that the information's out there, isn't it? I mean, no matter where you look, we can use frequency for energy. We can use the sun. We can use the wind. We can use wood. We can use anything, methane. We can use any number of things that are available to us every single day in our backyards, you know? Yet, these things are never, ever, ever discussed. There's no school, university, lab anywhere that will tell you that we have developed this. Now you got Elon Musk who's doing the solar thing, and he's created a whole city, completely, 100% controlled and, I don't think he even has wind generation. But he's got this big battery that has solved a problem that they had with being able to convert this energy into usable energy for the home on a continuous basis. Well, he solved that with the Tesla battery thing. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. This is innovation that counts. This is innovation that shows us that there is a better way. How come Elon Musk is the only one who is allowed to do this? Is it because the people who are in big energy are also shareholders with Elon Musk, that maybe they're in cahoots to where all of this science that is coming out is going to be gathered into this one corporation, just like Exxon, Shell, all of this, while Uchis, while Raymond, while Stephen, and all these other people who have been for years, decades, putting out this information, showing how simple it is to create energy, and their silence in the industry on these things.
The thing is, Patty, it's all about free energy's coming. It's going to be here no matter what they say, but it's going to be about who has control over hydrogen technology, who has control over wind and solar and all that kind of stuff. That's what it boils down to. What do you think?
Well, they've already shown us that, haven't they? People have gone, you know, there's people making heaters for their home out of aluminum cans. Yeah. You know, there's people who are producing building materials that insulate to the point of not having to have central air or heat. All of these things that people are creating, yet every time someone steps out and says, look what I've created, look how I can step off the grid and be totally self-reliant on sun, wind, water, whatever. How come those people are shut down, yet Elon Musk can build a city and nobody says a word?
Yeah. Well, you know what? If you ever went up into the attic of an old house during the summertime, you would experience something that just mind-blowing. That heat is so hot up in there that it'll make you sweat instantaneously, and it will take your breath away, literally. Have you ever been up in an attic in the middle of summer?
Yeah, I was born in the South. Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of heat pressure. There's a lot of energy just in the top of every house out there. And, you know, if you took that same doggone concept and you look back at the old Stirling engines and how they function with temperature difference and stuff like that, you could literally build a bad-to-the-bone, full-size Stirling engine outside your house just with the heat off your attic and the temperature difference of your basement. If you look at, you know, heat rises, cold air falls, just that simplicity right there. That's all you need is that temperature difference for thermoelectrics and Stirling engine type technology. So it is
steam energy. Didn't they used to run locomotives on steam?
Yeah.
What happened to that?
Still use it.
Let's go the opposite direction with your attic deal. Did you know that you build a house 2 or 3 feet off the ground and you put a lot of sand down? Put some plastic and then seal it and put some sand down and raise the edges of the plastic and then put water there. Now, you've got skirting around your house, right?
Yeah.
On the shady side of the house, you have a fan on the sunny side of the house. You blow the air out. That air coming through gets cold. 56 degrees on a 104 degree day. Well, now you don't just take that on the hot side and blow it out. You blow it up into some insulated ductwork and blow it into your house. Now you've got free air conditioning because you got a solar panel running the fan.
Well, yeah, that's there's a guy up in Sedalia, Missouri, and they call it Bosworth Castle. Right, and he literally built this castle over the top of an existing cave, and that when the wind blows against the side of the hill, it pumps cool air all the way up to the top of that doggone castle, and then and falls down through all the ductwork all the way through the deal. And
I love it.
You don't have to pay for AC.
Right. I mean, come on, man. And like I said, I've done experiments with this before. And the water gets to, I mean, on a 104 degree day, the water will be 56 degrees.
Well, that's why it always drives me insane when I think about the way that modern houses are built. They're built so, they're cracker boxes. They're made out of popcorn or popsicle sticks and trash, essentially, so that they can, you know, sell you a new one when it falls over, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, for $300,000.
Yeah. So, if society ever really would have got a grip on themselves way back when, we would have already been building houses that would be environmentally friendly and durable, that would last and stand the test of time, that would conserve resources and be self-contained. We could have all already been off the power grid. And if the government really was working for the people, they would want to take all the nation's resources to make their people energy independent, so that there wouldn't be no question of some terrorist blowing up the power grid or stuff like that. You know what I mean?
You know, yes, I do. You know, the thing is, most of the people, way more than the 3/4 of the people in the United States, are not old enough to remember how older houses were built. The eaves on your house, there were no two sides had the same length. The eaves were designed so that in the wintertime, when the sun is low, it would come under the eave and heat up the side of the house. But in the summer, when the sun was high, the whole entire side of the house would be in shade. And if, as the sun comes up in the east, it's lower. But there again, when it comes around, you know, toward the south and in the high sky, what I'm trying to say is, all four sides of a house, the eaves were of a different length. People knew how to build houses back then.
Yep.
Take this for example, the windows. The windows started at 6 inches above the floor and went all the way up to 6 inches within the ceiling. And the ceilings were always 10 or 11 foot high or more. Why? Because they were sash windows. You could lower the top sash or raise the bottom sash. So they would raise the bottom sash on the shady side of the house, lower the top sash on the sunny side of the house, so as the air heated up, it would go out the sunny side and pull the cool air in.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. People built houses for convenience.
Automatically drafting houses, man. They draft their own cool air through.
Yes.
So, like I said, I've been saying this so many doggone times, it ain't even remotely funny. Look, if you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it. It ain't that we don't have what we need, it's that we're using it inefficiently. And so for all those jive turkeys out there that want to argue with me about thermodynamics and try to convince me why it is you can't get out more than trying to put in, I'm trying to tell you, stop repeating what you heard in school. Because you're quoting it wrong to begin with. The laws of thermodynamics were there just to disprove perpetual motion, and we're not even trying to get perpetual motion. We're trying to allow nature to do what nature does and live comfortably in the process. That's all there is to it.
You know, another thing, too, about the older houses, they had wood or coal stoves out, you know, out somewhere close to the center of the room, and then they'd run the pipe back through the chimneys.
Yeah.
But they had a thing called a backdraft damper. Okay? Now, if you take an H-cap, which I have a video on YouTube showing people how to make an H-cap and install it and show them how well it works. A backdraft damper will increase the draft on your chimney even if there's not a fire in the stove. So people would put their backdraft damper up high. They would close the stove and close off the draft and everything in the summertime. And, of course, with the H-cap, called pulling a draft, it would take, that also would pull the heat out of the top and pull more cold air in through the shady side of the house. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah.
There's so many different ways that lost technology. It's lost. People don't even think about H-caps anymore.
Well, that's because the education systems failed people. I mean, right now everybody's running around hollering about global warming.
Yeah, right.
It drives me nuts, man. I mean,
they say global warming drives me crazy, but they start talking about climate change. Now I'm with them. I believe in that. Really do.
Yeah,
that's what happened in the 1600s.
That's
with
all.
Big deep freeze. You know, people in the world were starving to death. Literally, thousands were starving to death because they didn't adjust to the climate change in their area. Other people adjusted, they were having parties. The Thames River froze over for the first time in known history. And people went out on the Thames River and started having parties, carnivals. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah.
We have climate change. Scientists have proved it. We've gone through it 6-7 times.
Yeah, but see, it's not the word, it's the way that they twist
the way
the
word. They produce it. I mean, put it out there, yes.
Yeah, but nonetheless.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've seen it yet, Ram, and I posted a link in the chat room. I'll try to post it into this right here. But I put a T-shirt together because I'm trying to get a dialogue opened up. So look inside this Skype chat at this T-shirt. I'm going to try to find the most...
I've already seen it.
I want to find...
It's beautiful. I love it.
I want to find the best product at the lowest possible price because I'm not in this to make any money. I want to try to get these shirts out to people. And I promised a couple of really good friends I'm going to get them one. If I have these things made, I'm going to get them one for free, make sure that they got one. I want everybody to be able to have one if they want one. But... the phrase that's on there, mad science is the key to truth about free energy, and ask me why. That's what I want. I want to open up a dialogue with these shirts. I want them, ask me why mad science is the key. And the fact is that science has pretty much dropped the ball. Majority of the mainstream scientists, even though they're still out there doing research, and they for sometimes do some good work or whatever, as far as humanity, they literally dropped the ball and threw humanity under the bus, basically sold themselves to the devil for funding, and I'm not about to allow that to happen to mad science. Mad science is because I know we have the technology. We've proven we have the technology. It's not science fiction. It's not science fact. It's not trying to defy any of the known laws of physics. It is all based on scientific proven technology that is on the store shelf today, and all you have to do is figure out how to put the pieces in the right doggone order. You explained a few ways to draft cool air from one side and allow the heat to expand or escape out the other. That's because we know that cool air falls and heat rises, and once you've got that down, you know how to build your air ducts on your house to make it most efficient. And if it gets down to the best efficiency, then that means everyone can afford to use it.
I think I told you this once before, but, well, you know my in-laws are Mexican and live in Mexico, right? I was down there one summer visiting with them. It was about 104, 106 in the shade. And my mother-in-law and three or four of her lady friends were sitting under a tree. And they wasn't a picnic table, but it was like picnic park benches. And they were facing each other. And I noticed they were all sweating and wiping, had baby diapers. Because they absorbed so much water, they were wiping sweat off their face and foreheads and neck and stuff. And I looked up, and the way the wind was blowing, the wind was only blowing about 5 or 6 miles an hour. But there was a 6 or 7 foot cinder block wall about 20 feet away blocking the wind from them. So I said, oh, the heck with this. I just walked over, got the garden hose, and sprayed water up in the tree. Well, the tree's higher than the wall. So the wind comes across, evaporates the water, the cold air falls, and every one of these women got up, went home, and got a sweater and came back.
Huh.
Outdoor air conditioning.
There you go, man.
I mean, come on.
Folks, the answer's there. It's been there all along. Been trying to say it. You know, reason why I do my Mad Science channel on YouTube and this, the way I do it is there's a method to my madness, is because it seems like, I don't know what it is about this world, but if you try to talk science or common sense to the average Joe, it just you watch their eyeballs roll back in their head, and you lose them. They don't understand what it is that you're trying to say. It's not that they're stupid or nothing like that. It's just that they didn't pay attention enough in science class to understand the basic concepts of what you're trying to point out. And
the thing is, you're right. They're not stupid. There's a difference between stupid and ignorant.
Yeah.
Stupid means you can't learn. Ignorant means you haven't learned it yet.
If you think about what I'm saying, imagine making video games that are literally, without people knowing, teaching them something. You know, if you like what you're doing, if you enjoy your job, you'll excel at it. And so, if you like what you see, you're more apt to pay attention and you're more apt to learn something. So, if you make something fun, people want to learn it. If you make it simple, they can understand it really easy. It's the method of how you convey your information in order to teach somebody something that they might have missed otherwise. It's that simple. You know
these misters that they tell you to put underneath your eaves of your house or underneath your porch roof in the summertime? You take one of those. Put you an extension on the air breather for your carburetor, right? You put that mister in there. Now, the reason you want it on a downhill angle away from the carburetor, because it might produce more water than your engine would use. Well, you just simply take the overflow and strain it and put it back in your container. I did that in a 1970 Ford Ranger, back when the Ford Ranger was a full-size pickup truck. At 45 miles an hour, I could hit my windshield washer. That's what I used to pump the water. I hit my windshield washer motor, shoved the gasoline to the floor, and I could not pull my head off the back glass of that truck.
Well, if anybody's ever really paid attention while you're driving your vehicle out on a foggy day, for some reason your car seems to run better in the fog than it does out there in the dry air. And
because gasoline and air, when it burns in your engine, expands 450 times its size. When water turns to steam, it expands 1,600 times its size, 3.8 times more power.
Yep. Well, doggone it, we're down to the end of the show again because, time flies when you're having fun. But I got to get both y'all's opinion on it before we all leave up out of here. There's got to be some sort of solution in order to get people to finally come together. You know, I hate bringing it up because it starts off a controversy, but my method, my reasoning for it is completely different than the whole arguing back and forth of whether the earth is flat or not. But kudos to the flat earth community because they actually started themselves a corporation for research to find out whether or not it's true or not true. And, you know, like I said, everybody pay attention to this. I don't care whether it's flat or not. It's not the flatness or the roundness that I care about. It's the shape that it's in. But the reason why I'm interested in whatever you want to call it that's going on between the debate between the flat earth community and the ball earth community is the fact that it's opening dialogue that is actually causing each side to have to do physical research in order to be able to prove or disprove to win the debate. And as long as those minds, even where, however misguided, are out there looking into things to try to find out what makes things tick, then there might be a possibility that these guys can stumble onto things that I've been trying to shout out for years, and we might be able to get some work done. But the fact that they was able to start a corporation to literally put together scientific research to find out the truth, that may be what the alternative energy community has to do, is to gather together to get some sort of corporation put together that one day, maybe potentially, we could compete with the ones that are already out there and get real science done and get real products on the table, things that are going to last as opposed to planned obsolescence. You know, if it's about benefiting the people, what better way to benefit the people than to give them the necessities that should have been available all along? You see what I mean?
Yes, I do. I see exactly what you mean.
So, what do you think about that, Patty?
Well, I think that it's definitely a way to go. The problem that I have is. In we have a solar industry, we have a wind generator industry, right now that, like here in Kansas, we have thousands of acres of wind generators now, wind energy, and nothing's changed. We're still using the same electric poles that we used way back when, the same way of transferring energy. Every time, remember nuclear when it came out, it was the best thing, and it would make energy so cheap. What happened there? And the same thing, because every time these corporations start up and they become a source that is taken seriously, regulations and things are put upon them by the oil industry.
Yeah.
So what we have to do, I think, would be a better way, is to set up a global think tank of different people from different areas who are doing just exactly what you are doing, Shaziz, who are actually getting their hands in there and actually creating and showing these new forms of energy, new old forms of energy, the efficiency with which they can operate and everything. And these people start getting together and, we have like this crowdsourcing and things like this. Perhaps it would be more advantageous for us, because when we look at it, what we're trying to develop here doesn't need a factory. It needs each and every individual to become educated,
yeah,
and self-reliant. So what we need is a venue that is taken seriously, that is global, that is consistent. In other words, these people come to the table every week or every month or whatever, and we have this internet that allows anyone, no matter where they're at, to tap into information. Now, what if we got this consortium of globally intelligent backyard and garage scientists like you, Shaziz, who have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that these energy systems are creatable in a garage, you know?
Yeah.
And what if we did this on such a scale that we could put it on radio stations, real radio stations, you know, the hardwired radio stations, brick and mortars, that we could, in our communities, have, you know how they have a farmer's market?
Yep.
A farmer's energy market. Yeah, where people can come, because as long as we have to fight the current industry, we will not win, because they're instituted, they are cemented into the economy and into the control grid. They're not going anywhere until the people move away from them, you know, and we got to give them a reason. The problem is 99% of the people, they would believe and see what you were talking about and want to follow through on it, Shaziz, but they're not getting the information. We need to have you out there every week, every month, with all the others. We need to have your information put on pamphlets and in small booklets that we can pass on to everybody. This is education through knowledge. That's my idea.
What about a name like Knowledge Core helping you to use it better? I mean, it already exists, we're going to show you how to use it better.
whoa, that is great. Knowledge Core instead of the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
And not government funded, so the government has no control.
Yeah, that's it. Just basically brilliant minds joining Knowledge Corps to come together to show you how to use it better. I mean, we can use fuel more efficiently. We can use everything more efficiently. We can troubleshoot and brainstorm and make things that are so efficient that everyone can afford it. And it's not going to, you know, take their money out of their pocket, because they're still going to be selling the same product. We're just going to be using less of it because we're using it more efficiently. And they're the ones that keep telling us we should be using less of it.
Right.
Well, and they're going to be able, if they can come and they can hear this, if in their own communities they have access to this information, this global information, if they have a booklet, if they have papers written, you know, on these different forms of energy and how they can build them themselves out of what they have or things that are fairly inexpensive that they can purchase. I mean, just think, how many people do you think would turn their nose up and say, no, I would rather pay three-quarters of my wages for my energy consumption, for my home, my car, and such. I'd rather stick with that antiquated system rather than the energy independent. You know, there's not many people who would go that route.
Well, I think
think about this a minute. You save somebody money by like what Patty just said. Teach them how to they're getting more energy out of the energy they're using, so they're not using as much, so they're not spending as much. Look at how many more dollars they would have to send their kids to college and school, but the real school.
Yep.
Ones that teach the truth, not the bunch of bull crap.
Yeah.
And as far as the infrastructure, where the one lady in the documentary was talking about how we'd have to start off from scratch, that's a big hockahooey, because we could reuse a lot of it, but nonetheless, this system that I'm talking about with we're just hypothetically calling it Knowledge Core right now, making a better use of what you already got. Basically, that system would be a system where the people would literally build the infrastructure themselves. It would build itself.
Yes. Patty had a great idea here a while back. There's a bunch of towns up there where she lives that they'll almost give you the whole damn town if you'll just build it back up.
Well, that's maybe what we need to do, is get some town like that and take some time and actually build a self-contained system to show people an example of what could be done if they really, really want to try.
not just self-contained, but more than self-contained, so that it could distribute out.
Yeah.
You know, and get other people to do the same thing. Start one baby step at a time.
All right, well...
Small town, build some wind turbines, some water purification plants, solar panels, whatever. We build on all of our cars... be either super, super gasoline efficient,
yep,
or diesel running on not diesel fuel, but running on vegetable oil. Electric cars. I mean, do something like that.
Well, I'm going to make one more crazy statement before we close this show for today, but... people pass around that picture of that shirt and see how many people out there would actually be interested in having a shirt like that, would wear it around to help us spread the message. I'd like to get them somehow or another, get them a copy of this podcast too. If I send them a shirt, send them a copy of this podcast.
Have you done any research on what it would cost to do the shirts up?
Well, the actual site that I made that copy on there, it just seemed pretty expensive to me because it's like $20-some-odd for a shirt. I don't know.
Right.
And I don't. Okay. I think we could do it cheaper somehow.
They know somehow to it, son. I know some T-shirt manufacturers in Dallas and printers, and I will talk to them this week. That's my main job.
Well, I appreciate that. If you can find out, and we can get them reasonable, because I want to make sure everybody gets a decent product for, as cheap as possible. But that I think that this is a way that would help us out as far as spreading the word out there, because I want it to open a dialogue. That's why I said mad science is the key to truth about free energy. Ask me why. And then when people read that, why did you say that? And then we can tell them. But, spread that out there to see what people think about it. Show that picture around and see what people think about it, and maybe that'll help. But anyway, I said I wanted to say one last crazy thing, because that's what I do here on Mad Science Show. I talk madness and craziness. There are people who have massive solar arrays in their yard. My friend is one of them, and he's run into a few issues about wattage and temperatures and all that kind of stuff. And when I sat there one day and I told him that, you realize that if you was to use the amount of energy available in that solar panel setup, that you could literally run every single house in the town next to us with that amount of energy. And I swear, you would have thought I just kicked him in the whatever. And
yeah.
And he was like, you just don't know what you're talking about. That's it. No, you got to have this and that and whatever. And I'm saying, look, brother, that magnetic field or those coils do not care where that magnetic field comes from.
Right.
And at anything at 9 volts and above, you will burn a MOSFET out because it's got a lot of resistance and stuff like that. And it will cause them to get hot. But if you can keep those MOSFETs cool and still produce a strong magnetic field, you could pulse multiple coils with that amount of energy to go out to multiple different sources that are drawing a load off of those sources. And that circuitry that you got set up down there, and a combination of a rotary switch at the same time, you could take that amount of energy and you could just stretch it out all over the place and literally run an entire town off of one of those systems if it was done properly. And you would have thought I'd done said something that makes me, what do you call that, doggone it, what's the word I'm looking for, heresy or something like that.
Oh, yeah, really? A heretic.
Yeah, heretic. I'm I'm serious, because think about the power of hydrogen and oxygen separated. There's a lot of power there. All right, think about fuel being vaporized. There's a lot of power there. And it's no different with electricity. Like I said, those coils do not care where that magnetic field comes from. If it's a strong magnetic field and you allow that magnetic field time to do the full collapse, you will get out the maximum amount of current watts and amps and energy that you want. And so it's not about how fast you can turn this over. There's a sweet point. in there if you want a lot of current to be able to allow that field to get its strongest and then allow it to collapse. And if you've got multiple circuits in line with each other that are doing the same exact thing, you're getting just as much magnetic pulse out of those coils as you would be as if you were doing it mechanically using permanent magnets. You see what I mean?
Yep.
And I know it sounds crazy, but I will prove it eventually. I'll prove what exactly what it is that I'm saying. I've been putting these videos out there like rotary switch and challenging people. Make it better.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
God's name is going on in here. What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.